Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Two-thirds a person, great things and beatings and suffering and worsens. Black human packages tied up in strings. Black rage can come from all these kinds of things. Black rage is founded on blatant denial, squeezed economics, subsistence survival, deafening silence and social control. Rage is found in all wounds in the soul.
In the past decade alone, January 24th, 2004, Timothy Stansberry, Brooklyn, New York, unarmed. November 25th, 2006, Sean Bell, Queens, New York, unarmed. January 1, 2009, Oscar Grant, Oakland, California, unarmed. January 29th, 2010, Aaron Campbell, Portland, Oregon, unarmed. July 18th, 2011, Alonzo Ashley, Denver, Colorado, unarmed. March 7th, 2012, Wendell Allen, New Orleans, Louisiana, unarmed. September 14th, 2013, Jonathan Farrell, Charlotte, North Carolina, unarmed. July 17th, 2014, Eric Garner, Staten Island, New York, unarmed. August 9th, 2014, Michael Brown, Ferguson, Missouri, unarmed.
The story begins with the death of Baldwin's father, which happened just before the shooting. He was a severe man, a minister who was suspicious of all white people, but after James left home to work in New Jersey, after he was refused service in bars and restaurants and bowling alleys because of the color of his skin, he began to understand his father's point. He realized that his father had carried, as he put it, the weight of white people in the world. The trouble in Harlem that summer started because a white man had shot a black man.
This is about Trayvon Martin. This is about Jordan Davis, Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Ezeel Brown, who was shot in L.A. a couple days ago. Today in St. Louis, I think you said a couple blocks away, another African American man was shot and killed today. They said he had a knife. But I just think there's a war on the black male, and it's tearing the country apart.
Driver, let me see your hands. Everybody stick their hands out the window.
So how did this happen? Officers say they got a 911 call of a driver speeding down the highway waving a gun. So they pulled over Kamitra Barber's car thinking she was the suspect. In less than a minute, though, they realized they got the wrong car, but by that time, the kids were freaking out.
It's okay.
No,
everything's
fine.
No, it's going to jail.
Hey,
stop crying. It's okay.
You can't just say, okay, I'm sorry, and then I'm over it. I can't. I mean, every time I listen to or hear or think about it, it bothers you.
What's even more confusing about all this is Barbara drives a burgundy Nissan, and the 911 call said the suspect was in a tan Toyota, making it even more unclear why police pulled her over.
All these kinds of things, and then I'll be so bad.
And he went on to say that black men had no rights, which the white man was bound to respect. No rights, which the white man was bound to respect. No rights, which the white man was bound to respect. No rights, which the white man was bound to respect.
Right on. Context of white supremacy. Justice Gus T. Benegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Tuesday, August 26th, 2014. So I've been told. We were supposed to have Dr. Tommy Curry in with us, making his third visit to the program this evening, but I'm not seeing him on the line, unless I've been confused, unless he has a new number. If you are with us, feel free, press star 6, but I was looking out for his number, and I did not see it. I dropped him an email just as a reminder to make sure that we were on for this evening, but I have not heard back from him at this point. I'm not sure if something happened or if he had a scheduling conflict, emergency, something of that sort, but I'm not seeing him with us at this point. I'll try and give it a bit of time to see if he's going to be joining us or if he just won't be able to make it for the program this evening. I was looking forward to hearing he has some essays that he has written that are all of his content is relative to white supremacy, but specifically to what's been going on for about the past 2.5 weeks or so with the events in Ferguson, as well as all of the other numerous incidents of white terrorism in the form of racist suspect enforcement officials stopping unarmed black people, entire black families in some cases at gunpoint, killing black people, bludgeoning black people, the whole works. And I was looking forward to kind of getting his response, what he has observed in all of this, and what would be the best response, in his opinion, in terms of what black people can do long term in response to this, and how best to try to take advantage of the amount of energy and focus on racism, white supremacy right now, when you have so many people talking about this as a major problem. As I take a moment, I will, I guess this is what I'll do. I'll give him maybe another 15 minutes or so to see if he'll be hanging out with us this evening. What I'll do, I'll give myself a commercial break. That way I can send him a text message. I did have a report I was going to share yesterday. Actually, I have two reports, so I'll take a quick commercial. That'll give me the time to get a text message off to him, and then I'll have two reports that I can share, one in relation to the program that we had yesterday evening with Mr. E.R. Bills, racist. Actually, you're not in the suspect category if you are engaged in any sort of sexual activity with a non-white person, and he is married to a black female, so he is not in the suspect category. At any rate, I did have one report from Mr. Bills, and then one article that I thought was interesting as well, which is also in the same category. But I will give myself a quick commercial just so that I have time. I'll send a text to Dr. Curry to see if he will be visiting with us, and then I'll come back. I'll share those two reports, and hopefully he'll be with us in the interim. If not, we will reload. If anybody has anything they want to share, we should have time for that. If he's not with us, and then we'll reload, and we should be back tomorrow. So a quick commercial. I'll send the text, see what's what, and I'll come back and have those two reports as well. Context of white supremacy.
RacismDaily.com, your number one source for global news reports on race, racism, and overt actions of white supremacy. From Asia to the Americas to Europe to Australia to Africa, racism is not a thing of the past. It is our current reality. Be informed. Be globally informed. You should be the first to know. RacismDaily.com, RacismDaily.com, RacismDaily.com.
Is racism hurting you? On issues of race, are you unable to speak, think, and act with clarity and confidence? Are you tired of laughing when nothing is funny, smiling when you are not happy, agreeing when you really disagree? CounterRacism.com, you can learn specific strategies and techniques to counter the behaviors of the people who practice racism in all areas of activity. Using words correctly, following counter-racist logic, even counter-racist science projects designed to reveal what racism is, how it works, and how to counter it. The open source code writing format allows you to pick and choose from a variety of counter-racist suggestions so you can produce the code that works for you. Stop by counterracism.com today and help replace racism with justice.
That's counter-racism.com.
Do you need a one-stop shop for all of your multimedia needs? Triumphant Multimedia is a skilled team of professionals with a passion for great marketing and chic design. Our specialties include consulting, brand development, copywriting, and creative graphic design that's second to none. We also offer photography, photo retouching, videography, and video editing. At Triumphant Multimedia, our goal is to provide highly effective creative solutions built to suit any individual need or budget. Give us a call at 678-732-8067 or check us out online at trimultimedia.com.
Everyone, welcome. This is Justice with the Cows Radio program. If you want to learn about, understand, and counter racism, white supremacy, be sure not to miss a Cows episode. We keep them jammed, packed with constructive information to sharpen your use of words to help eliminate the system of racism, white supremacy, ASAP. Also, to be able to invest in my counter-racist efforts, co-hosting the Cows Radio program, please visit my blog, justdojusticetoday.blogspot.com.
You're just saying just buckets and buckets of words.
I got an uncle real crazy. My Uncle B, 55 years old, hates white people, married to a white lady. And he's sitting around going, you know, these crackers ain't shit, except for Susan. He tried to explain the whole thing to me one day, say, yeah, I got a white wife, I love her, she love me, that's all that matter. But I tell you this, if the revolution ever come, I'll kill her first. Just to show these crackers I mean business. Motherfucker, cracker ass, motherfucker, cracker. Shit, cracker, motherfucker. What? Hey, hi, honey. Motherfucker, cracker, I'll kill my cracker kids, too.
Right on. Alrighty. I was able to text Dr. Curry, so we'll see what's going down for the evening. Two reports that I will share while I give some time to see if he will be with us. The first report, I put this on my Facebook page yesterday. I did email the author to see if perhaps maybe we can get him on the program. I thought it was just why it reveals quite a bit about the system of white supremacy and the incorrectness of sexual intercourse between non-white people, black people, and white people. Should never happen. It's terrible all the way around, and I have pretty much seen this every time without exception. But the report, it's at theguardian.com. It is titled, "I'm Black, My Brother's White, and He's a Cop Who Shot a Black Man on Duty." I will share, this was just posted yesterday. Apparently very popular. It's one of the top articles on The Guardian still. It was the number one article for most of yesterday, at least according to what I saw, and it's still in their top five today. Zach Stafford, non-white male, white parent, wrote this piece. He writes, "My white brother loved black people more than I did when we were growing up. As a black interracial child of the South, one who lived in a homogeneous white town, I struggled with my own blackness. I struggled even more with loving that blackness. But my brother, Mitch, didn't. He loved me unapologetically. He loved me loudly. He also loved screwing with other people's expectations. Whenever we met new people or I joined a social situation he was in, Mitch would make sure I was standing right next to him for introductions and say, 'This is Zach, my brother,' and then go silent with a smirk. These new acquaintances would then scan back and forth with such intensity, black, white, white, black, that our faces became a kind of tennis court with strangers waiting for someone to fault. Eventually, someone would awkwardly laugh and say something like, "Oh, adopted brother," immediately looking relieved to have figured it out. My brother would deny that and push the line further. "No, like my brother. We have the same mom. We are blood." That would lead to someone questioning me intensely, and each time, my white brother would stand next to me, proud, prouder than me of my own skin. And over the years, as he continued playing this game, I became prouder with his help. And then, years later, and far away in Chicago, I got the phone call. My brother, now a cop, had shot an unarmed black man back in Tennessee. He does have the link to the shooting that folks can check out. I'll post that as well. Apparently the victim, the black male that he shot, died and had a 2-year-old son. Continuing. Hearing about black men dying is never exactly a surprise. Every day you see the news stories. On the news, black men die while getting Skittles. Trayvon Martin was not a man. On the news, black men die in chokeholds. On the news, black men die for playing their music too loud. Jordan Davis was not a man. It seems black men die on the news more than they do almost anything else on the news. Even with a black president in office, every 28 hours, a black man is killed by a police officer in America. I just never imagined that the police officer in that scenario would ever be my brother. Mitch was supposed to be different than all the rest. He was supposed to be different because of me. The first thing I did after I got the phone call was Google my brother's name. I saw a mix of headlines. Some outlets were more sympathetic toward the unarmed 22-year-old victim, while other coverage was more favorable to my brother, the cop who accidentally killed someone. Articles kept using that word, accidental, over and over, and it felt like aloe on a burn. Watching the first press conferences later that day, the police spokesman talked about how my brother was just doing his job, that he followed protocol, and that this was just a tragic accident for everyone involved. At that press conference, one of the local news stations in Nashville aired a more in-depth look at the case and reported that the victim had a family member who had been shot by someone on the police force years earlier, also apparently by accident. Accident seemed like an odd word to me for this situation. When I hear the word accident, I usually think about spilled milk, or the dog urinating on the carpet, or even bumper scratch. Accidents were things that you respond to with, "Whoops, sorry." But with this accident, I wondered, to whom could we even say sorry now that a man lay dead? While I watched, I kept thinking about why these accidents always seem to happen to black people, and why they were called accidents, when it seemed so clearly to me to be much more than an accident, when it seemed to be a flaw in a system that called things accidents. I stared at my computer after my screen went black and prayed that it was an accident, because calling it that didn't make me feel I had to choose my race over my blood. The strangers who asked me questions over the brother who wanted them to. I went home to Tennessee a few years later, after the media coverage of the case had calmed down, and sat in one of my chairs in my mother's living room and let the argument happen. My mother, with her smooth milk skin, stared at me with eyes that would not unlock from my own. "Do you actually think he shot him because he was black?" she asked, tearing up. Oh my, the weeping white woman. "Yes, I do. I really do. But how can you say that? Honestly, he is blacker than you. I winced at her backwards compliment, the racism veiled as praise, the description I'd heard since I could write my name. Mom, that is simply not true. He is white. This will never change, no matter what he does. Never. And because I am black, I know that if that man would have been white, he would be alive today. My mom finally unlocked eyes with me and stared down at her glass. I could see that she wanted to agree with me, but couldn't this time, because it was an indictment of her other son. She had probably never imagined having to argue with her black son about her white son shooting and killing an unarmed black man while on duty. But that's also when I began to see just how much racism isn't really about a single act or a single person, but rather a much larger system, a system that calls the recurring death of black male bodies accidents. No matter how my mom had raised us, no matter how much my brother loved my blackness and was so proud of me for who I was, it still didn't stop another black man from losing his life. My white brother isn't a racist. And he didn't intentionally kill that man because he was black. But that's not the point. In his case, in Ferguson, and in so many other cases, we see the deaths of unarmed black men as accidents. And until the day we all recognize them as casualties of something much bigger, we will continue to see black men dead on the news. We will continue to see brothers killing brothers. Again, Mr. Zach Stafford, non-white male with a white parent. The title of the report: I'm black, my brother's white, and he's a cop who shot a black man on duty. Fascinating. Fascinating. The other report for folks who tuned in, which is very much related to what we just heard and the broadcast from yesterday. For folks who, maybe if you heard or did not, yesterday evening we had E.R. Bills on the program. He authored a book, The 1910 Slocum Massacre, detailing one of many incidents of white terrorism that took place in Slocum, Texas, July of 1910, where an untold number of black people were slaughtered by whites. They fabricated, there are many theories, but a reoccurring premise is that white people fabricated this notion that the black people in Slocum were arming themselves and preparing some sort of ambush of innocent white people. And this turned out to be grossly untrue. There was never any shred of evidence to substantiate such a claim, which is pretty common. This is a recurring theme in white supremacy all the way up to 2014, where you have all these unarmed black people being shot, bludgeoned, beaten, arrested, pulled over at gunpoint, where they end up being innocent, unarmed, weren't doing anything incorrect, but have had to go through all of this terrorism. But the premise that these black people had done something justified killing, and I mean, the estimates go all the way up from a couple dozen all the way up to 200 or more, because you had hundreds of white people who came from all over the area, didn't even live in this town, came in with the opportunity to kill black people, and they killed all kinds of black people, black children, black females, black males, everybody. They even had an anecdote in the book where a white person described, it was a group, they went to a black house, the black people weren't doing anything, they weren't rioting, they weren't looting, they weren't raping babies, they were just sitting quietly in their house, and the white people came and shot the house up. A six-year-old black child attempted to escape from the rear of the house, and they shot and killed the 6-year-old black child as well. So, really gruesome incident. We were talking about that with Mr. Bills, who is a white man who married a black female. We also were really fortunate to have one of the descendants on the program as well, Miss Constance Holly Jawade. She's a principal in Texas, and she talked about how her father, grandparents, other family members had talked to her about this incident when she was a young child, and that she is continuing to pursue justice in this case. And the land that they stole, which is a common thread in these incidents, what happened in Tulsa, what happened in Rosewood, and many other incidents there, white people, Elliot Jasmine has written a book about this. He says that there were well over 200 of these types of incidents that took place just in this area of the world alone. Where black people were killed or threatened with death if they didn't vacate a particular area, and then white people would swoop in and take all of their property, either without compensating them at all, or maybe they give them, you know, a nickel for 10 acres or something ridiculous like that. At any rate, we were on discussing getting some of the details of the book, some of Mr. Bill's views on racism, some of Miss Jawade's views on racism. Mr. Bills became defensive because he said that we were implying or suggesting that he was racist. Now, he said his evidence for this was that that we didn't agree when we asked him if there was ongoing genocide being waged against black people. And he said he didn't agree. And then he said that poor white people have more in common with poor black people than they do with other white people. And both myself and Ms. Jawade, we both disagreed and provided evidence as for why that was false. And that's really a cliched way that people talk about racism, that poor white people need to unite with black people. I've never seen any evidence that that's going to happen, not to any sustained level. And I don't see any evidence now that any group of white people is interested in identifying with non-white people, black people, and ending the system of racism. I just see no evidence of that. At any rate, I was transitioning to ask him, this is towards the end of the program, I was about to ask him about sexual intercourse between white people, black people. This is a major theme in his book. As I said, they don't really have firm evidence as to what sparked white people to begin killing all these black people in Slocum, 1910. But one of the theories in the book is that perhaps maybe a black person, or maybe even more than one black person, thought about, dreamed about, brushed up against a white woman, and that this, you know, led to dozens, maybe even hundreds of black people being killed. I was going to ask him if he thought that white people engaging in sexual intercourse with black people, if this was something that would work towards ending permanently racism. He was no longer with us. So I'm, you know, like, what's going on? Where is Mr. Bills at? I did not call him for the program. He and Ms. Jawade, they both dialed us. So I'm looking for him on the switchboard. I don't see his number. I emailed him. I was checking my email as well. I didn't get an email from him, text, anything. I'm just like, you know, where, what happened? Did his phone die? What is going on? So I email him after the program, you know, like, I don't know what happened. You were disconnected from us, and I was, you know, trying to get in one more question before we wrap things up. And then I didn't get an email from you as well to explain what happened. And I said, you know, if you willfully departed the program, that is pretty discourteous, in my opinion, act of racism, I would say as well. But I, you know, thanked him for hanging out with us and all that. So he wrote me back today, and I said I would read what he said. He did say that that his battery died. That was his explanation for departing so abruptly, that his battery died and he was not able to ring us back. I don't know if that's true or not. I did say on the program yesterday that Mr. Bills is married to a black female, which I thought that is an act of racism, maximum racist aggression. It is totally exploiting, molesting a non-white person who is in a weak position. I wouldn't care when it happens, as long as the system of white supremacy exists. You're not on the suspect list when you do that. But I did want to get that in as well. And quite a few people that listened to the program thought that that was interesting timing when his battery died at that moment, when him being asked about that question, particularly since he had told me in private that he was married to a black female. But he said that that wasn't necessarily something that he wanted to discuss on the program, even though he said that he felt that that gave him special insight into the problem of racism. I know some of the folks had commented about the caller towards the end of the program who I think his comments, I'm paraphrasing, he said that, number one, we should not talk about whites and blacks because that suggests that all white people are racist. He said that we should not do that because it might upset some white people who are listening, and we don't want to do that. He said that we need to help each other, because that had been said in the program earlier. I think Mr. Bill said that Mr. Wade, who again is a black female, that she had helped him understand some things about racism. And he said he has baggage as a white man in a system of racism. He grew up around lots of racist white people. He says he had his own baggage, and she said that she would help him carry it. And the caller said that that's what we need to do. We need to help each other carry our baggage. And he was making another comment, or he was going to ask me about my thoughts on that. And then he, before I answered his question, I wanted to know, am I talking to a white person? Am I talking to a black person, non-white person? Give us your racial classification. And he said, well, see, that's part of the problem and blah, blah, blah. And he was going into this long, drawn out explanation. And I said, you know, hey, we're kind of at the end of the program here. This is not a question that should require a 10-page report. This should not require 5 hours of dialogue. What is on your driver's license? And he refused to answer the question again. He started just giving buckets and buckets of words and blah, blah, blah. And it's difficult and it's complicated and all this. And, you know, hey, we are not, you're not just going to talk and talk and talk and not answer the question. That is pivotal. That is one of the first questions that I asked Mr. Bills on the program. Are you a white man? Yes. We didn't have a 5-hour debate. What does it mean to be white? Race is a social construct. This is all fabricated. I mean, that is total nonsense. I don't know if I said that to him, but I mean, I don't really have a lot of patience for that, because I mean, that is just foolishness of the highest order. Mr. Eric Garner, Marlene Pinnock, the black female who was savagely beaten by that white brute enforcement official in California a couple months back. I don't think Eric Garner or Miss Pinnock could say, hey, wait a minute now. Race is a social construct. Don't you be treating me like a nigger, because that's just all made up. We're all a part of the human family. I don't think that's going to work. I don't think you're going to be able to say that and get a racist to back up off. Oh, my bad. My bad. You're right. Social. Yep. We're all in the same family. I'm sorry. My bad. Go on about your business. Go ahead and do what you do, Mr. Brown. Go ahead and do what you do, Ezell Ford. Go ahead. Do what you do, Kamitra Barber, the black female who was pulled over at gunpoint with her children in the vehicle past couple days down in Texas, where they thought she was driving crazy, or they had suspected her of having a weapon in the car. And then after they handcuffed her and pulled them over at gunpoint, traumatized her entire family, then, oh, we made a mistake. Our bad. I don't think you're going to be able to do that and get housing. I don't think you'll be able to do that and get the police to no longer harass you. I mean, it just makes no sense. So I would not allow him to continue and just keep talking, since he would not just say what was on his driver's license. And he said, well, you don't have to mute me. I'll hang up the phone. And I said, that was fine. Some people had commented about that as well and thought that he might have been a non-white person who was white identified, just from some of the things he said at the beginning. To me, it suggested that he might have known some of our guests. I don't know, Mr. Bills, maybe Mr. Wade, maybe both of them. They're both in Texas. I don't know. But yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting as well. At any rate, I got in. Okay, I got a comment from Mr. Curry. He said that he saw the time on Facebook. Man, Facebook, I hate Facebook. He said he saw the time on Facebook and he thought it was 8 p.m. Central, as opposed, he's in Central, so it would be 7 p.m. His time. I think the time on Facebook does say Eastern, but you know, I'm no fan of the social media stuff. Facebook foiled our broadcast, so we'll see if we can juggle and reschedule with Dr. Curry to make sure everything is cool in the game. But he did apologize and said that was his fault for getting the time incorrect for the program. At any rate, I did see one person who called in. Oh, there, he's on the line right now. I guess I'll tap, since he's with us, I'll get his line here. Dr. Curry? Dr. Curry, are you there?
You can return to this menu from anywhere on the system by pressing the star key 4 times.
That's interesting.
Hello?
Yes, sir. Dr. Curry, can you hear us?
Yes, sir. Yes, I can.
Right on. Outstanding. Good to hear from you.
Yes, sir.
Enter the last 4 digits of the party line you want to join, or to hear a directory of all systems, press star. You can return to this menu from anywhere on the system by pressing the star key 4 times.
I don't know what's causing that. Hopefully it won't be a recurring thing. At any rate, for folks listening,
enter the last 4 digits of the party line you want to join or to hear a director.
Having some technical difficulties today?
I'm not sure. I reckon so. I don't know if that's coming from your line or someplace else.
I can serve it. I can try calling back in.
Okay, let's try that.
All right.
Cool. Enter. Okay, yeah, I think that was coming from his line. We'll wait to see if we can get him back on the line. So I guess we are. I see the person who dialed in with a hand up, but I guess we are shifting gears, and we will have Dr. Curry with us. Always a hoot to hear his views on the system of racism, white supremacy. He is a professor at Texas A&M, down in Texas. Lots of things going on in Texas as well. This is his third time visiting with us. You can go back in the archives to get some of the earlier programs that he's done with us to get his perspective. All right, I see him, and he's dialed back in. All righty, let's try it again. Dr. Curry, are you with us?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, I am.
Outstanding. Hopefully we won't have those prompts for whatever other rooms folks can go to. So cool to have you on the broadcast again. Glad
you
were able to navigate through everything. We'll try and cover as much material as we can with the time we have.
Absolutely.
Just, I guess, real quick for folks, this might be their first time hearing from you. Anything you think they should know about you, the work that you do?
Yes, sir. I work on anti-colonialism and critical race theory. Mostly my work is focusing on black men and anti-black death and white supremacy. So I try to write about that seriously and in connection to the things that we actually see in the world before us. One of my major criticisms of intervention in black philosophy is that even though we're doing black philosophy, we don't actually study black people. We're rather repeating simple moralities and ideological programs that have kind of been set forth for a currency without actually doing a material study of the conditions that black people suffer under.
I think that is going to come up in discussing some of the things that have been happening with Ferguson and some of the other incidents that have been major reports, major events over this summer. I guess before I get with that, this is critical. This came up on the program yesterday. It comes up all the time, and I really try to do everything that I can to totally eviscerate this mythology, this fiction that the reason we keep having Renisha McBride's or Eric Garner or Michael Brown Jr. or Ezell Ford, this is the result of white ignorance. And I thought you did a phenomenal job kind of laying that out. I think it was the second time you visited with us, just giving some great analysis of why that just is absolute malarkey and that it can't be that white people are ignorant, but it's always to the detriment of black people. Someone, they even made a YouTube clip of that piece, which I greatly appreciated.
Right.
I think the with Darren Wilson, who is the racist suspect enforcement official in Ferguson who killed Michael Brown Jr., he has raised, according to the latest figures that I've seen, close to $500,000 in less than 3 weeks for what, many white people who are supporting him and saying that he's been tarred in the press and he hasn't been given we haven't heard his side of the story. People have just leap to crucify him. I even saw one report where they said the media is lynching Darren Wilson. I thought that was astounding for many reasons. But
yes, it is.
For some of the people who have chipped in to raise this nearly $500,000, the comments that they have left, I think, reveal a lot. And I just wanted to get your thoughts. I'll share a few comments and then get your thoughts about if this is the result of white ignorance, some of the remarks that they left. Better to be judged by 12 than carried by 6. Different comment. I know a lynch mob when I see one. They have nothing to do with justice, and I believe in justice for everyone. Another one. Thank you for putting the feral ape down so it couldn't attack any more people. And they said it, not he. It couldn't attack any more people. And the last one. Thank you for all your service to our great country as a law enforcement officer. There are many others. There were so many, in fact, that they even had to turn the comments off on one of his fundraiser pages. Is this white ignorance?
Absolutely not. You know, and this is something that we really need to disavow people of, is the idea that when black people, specifically black men, because that part's very important, when black men are killed, that somehow white people are reacting to this out of ignorance. As I said before, what this seeks to do is maintain white virtue. It has nothing to do with the implicit biases and some of the conscious and explicit biases that white people have towards black men. The work of Philip Atiba Goff is good in this, The Essence of Innocence, where he's talking about the process of adultification, or even black boys who are ages 10 or 11 are seen as if they're much older and much more culpable for their decisions. So what we see here is the process whereby black men specifically, but black women too, are divorced or devoid of any kind of innocence or childhood. So this is one of the reasons that, as I mentioned last time, is that you can kill somebody like a Trayvon Martin or a Jordan Davis, teenagers, and they don't speak about them as children. So what we see here is the compounding of that, this lack of childhood because you're murdering a child, on top of the fact that they see all these black men as racist beasts, as black beasts that's simply going to, you know, attack white people or white community or white civilization or white women, etc. And we don't want to have a grasp on that. I mean, this is one of the failures of the university, is that we have all these celebrity, you know, academics going down to Ferguson trying to get themselves heard. But, as you know, I said this on Twitter a few days ago. How many of them are actually writing articles or have a research program surrounding anti-black death, or in this case, black men? See, so what we're doing is that we're creating a situation where we're condemning white people for their racism, which we absolutely should do. But we offer nothing to enhance the ways that black people, both in the university and on the ground, understand and can deal with this racism. You know, people are talking about, well, we need to revolt, we need to protest. Sure, but you're protesting against people who are already using guns, tear gas, and tanks on your streets. So this doesn't become a situation like the 1960s. We're talking about the modernization of anti-black technology. We're talking about the modernization of anti-black killing weapons, machinery, and apparatus. And people don't want to talk about how we need to change our strategies. They're still marching on the streets as if this is a ploy for recognition. What we see in them supporting Darren Wilson is that every white man that kills a black man is made a hero in the national imagination. This is the same thing that happened to George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin. Think about the impact of this. You're taking a private citizen, somebody who simply has anger issues, was delusional, and was even admitted by some of the jurors in the aftermath that they messed up. They got in too deep. And they're made into a national hero because you have enough white people that support the killing of black men that they give them an honorific status. But nobody speaks about that. Right, we talk about Rekia Boyd in Chicago, which we should, because that sister was killed unjustly. But we don't talk about Antonio Cross, because that was the black man the cop was trying to shoot when he accidentally killed Rekia Boyd. So what we have here are deaths of black people, but it's not based on the kind of identity politics that we keep hearing on Twitter and the media, etc. It's built on the fact that they're coming in to get black men, and that black women are the collateral damage of that type of state and private citizen violence. So if we're going to analyze anti-black violence and death, we have to understand that there is a male ontology behind it that's endangering not only the lives of these young black men and these black boys, but it's also endangering our sisters, our mothers, and everyone else that's around us. And that's why we have the militarization of Ferguson. We have the militarization of people fearful of the fact that these black men that are rioting, looting, etc., are going to do more harm to a community, a white community that they're trying to protect. And that becomes a rationalization not only for them occupying Ferguson, but in the minds of these other white people across the country, why they should lend support to the putting down of black men and boys. And this is a problem that we don't want to discuss because it runs up against identity politics in the university, and we don't want to have the conversation in society because all the black men are being taken away. So we're trying to at least least protect the people that we can and go through the civil rights motif, which is why we appeal to people like Jackson and Sharpton, and we're asking the president to say something. But the young man is dead, so we're out of options, so to speak, because his life is gone. Now we can only appeal for recognition, because people ultimately don't want to see revolution. They just want to threaten it so things will change.
What if the pushback came where you say a lot of your analysis that, and I think I retweeted the tweet that you're talking about, where in terms of asking people, you know, do any of these folks, are they willing to put their career on the line to talk seriously about the violence that black males, black boys face? Melissa Harris Perry, she did a big segment on her program last week where she was talking about violence against unarmed black males exclusively. She did a big roll call of folks leading up to Eric Garner, Sean Bell, Ezell Ford, Michael Brown Jr. There's been lots and lots of talk over the past month or so from a great many people, even President Obama with his Brothers Keepers initiative, where people would say, you know, hey, Dr. Curry, I've heard tons of people talking about the plight of black males over the past month, definitely. And this is something that even gets discussed pretty regularly when people talk about racism. What would your response be?
My response would be, look at the pushback that you get from academics. So look at the website Dissent. Nicole Alexander Floyd just wrote an article that criticizes Michelle Harris Perry, talking about specifically saying that she's undercut the black feminist movement because she still believes in an endangered species type of logic. I would ask them to look at the types of responses you get against My Brother's Keeper by black feminists, specifically Kimberly Crenshaw, who's arguing that this is really another perpetuation of erasing gender and black women from a discourse where they need help too. Conceptual apparatus, because most of them are empirical, like talking about issues of employment, matriculation, things of that sort. There's not a real discussion about black men and genocidal logics that happen in our society the way that you have in other journals based on intersectionality, feminism, etc. Right, so there's a public attention, right, and this is the problemization between the public and the university. There's a public attention to how black men are killed. We see them and we show them on the boards where they're always on the nightly news. But what we don't have are conceptual explanations for that, because all we do is keep talking about racism. Right, but if we don't understand that there are specific types of racism, some kind of white supremacist logic that seeks to crucify black men, then we're not really getting to the heart of the issue. Because, I mean, we have to be, let's be honest about this, right? When we see black men and their interaction with the cops leads them to death, when you have someone like Eric Garner that gets choked out on national, through video cam, and you see this on TV, I mean, you know, look at Oscar Grant, you see that on YouTube, you can see, you can Google any number of black men being killed by the cops in this society, right? And we say, look at that death. But what happens to our understanding of those people's bodies after that death? Trayvon Martin was a year ago. Now he's a name. He's a hashtag. He's a hashtag now for Michael Brown, right? That's what I mean when I say that we don't have a real conceptual analysis or theory about why black men are being killed in this country, because we don't want to actually study them in the university. And then when we talk about the people that are losing them in society, we're talking about marginalized economic and political communities. So it's not like they have the power to stand up against militarized police forces in Ferguson. As I said again on Twitter, you know, and I've said on my Facebook page, one of the reasons this is getting so much attention is because it got caught on camera and it happened in broad daylight. But what happens when those cameras and when these public intellectuals no longer care about Ferguson and they go to the next big thing in a week or two? What happens to those people? What's going to happen? How are they going to respond to the backlash that the cops and the police force that we see is clearly racist and against the community there are going to have on them? What's going to happen when the national attention turns elsewhere, right? We don't have long-term strategies for that. And then when we do try to introduce long-term strategies, we get what we got with My Brother's Keeper. We get people fighting for resources. We have black people saying, well, yeah, black men die, but black girls suffer too, that the president now is dealing with daddy's issues, right? These are the types of things that happen, and one of the reasons that we never have any kind of solidarity, or even if we want to move beyond the politics, a real understanding of how we're going to deal with anti-blackness, because it affects black men and black women differently.
What would your response be? I know Dr. Jawanza Kanjufu, he's been a guest on the program before. He's publishing a new book on educating black girls. He writes, after a woman at an event for educators in Oakland, California, challenged Dr. Kanjufu and everyone present to pay attention to black girls, Dr. Kunjufu decided to look into it. I did a literature review, and I did not like what I saw. These figures are unacceptable. If these things were happening to white girls, it would be a major national crisis. Black girls are being suspended from school at rates second only to black boys, except in Wisconsin, where black girls are suspended more than anyone else, according to a U.S. Department of Education civil rights study. The high school dropout rate among black girls is 40%. I think a lot of folks would take that analysis as well as Renisha McBride, Marlene Pinnock, and say, hey, black females have a very tough time with violence from white males and white females, police officers. We have a very tough time, and that frequently is not acknowledged or put on the back burner while the focus of racism speaks as though only black males are victims of racism. What would your response be?
Well, I think the question has to be, what do they mean when they say that they think it's overshadowed? Right, I would never argue that black women are affected. In fact, my work actually argues that because of racism, black women are affected next to their other racial counterparts. So that's why you see the types of disparities between black girls and white girls, for instance, right? Because you have think about it, you have systems of people that are all in the same neighborhoods, all in the same schools, all going through the same economic crisis. Of course, the black woman in that is going to be affected by that as well. That's my point about why some of these arguments about identity politics don't really make sense when you study them structurally, because you're talking about people in the same neighborhood. Just like they say, well, black men own more, they're worth more, $100 versus $6,000 or $7,000. Yeah, but $6,000 doesn't mean you live in a different neighborhood or you have better access to health care. It just means that somehow you may own the house or own the car. So I think that's my first response. That's obvious. That's not an aha moment. I think my second response would be, well, what do you mean when you say that it's overrepresented? When you talk about something like Renisha McBride or Ayanna Stanley, you're talking about people who have organized around them. One of the pieces I wrote with my wife for a racism review specifically looks at the Hayden Pendleton case where, you know, Michelle Obama comes down and says, look, you know, this, we have to do something about violence in Chicago. I say, look, this is something that happened. This is what's happening to our communities, not just black men or women. But because you have this disproportionate, where black men are killed at such a higher rate, they're incarcerated at such a higher rate. Like, when we think about federal prison, we're talking about like 26,000 to over 555,000, right? That's the kind of disparity we're talking about, where homicide is the number one killer for black men, like ages 1 through 4, and then from 16 to like 32. I mean, if we're talking about those types of disparities, where that's kind of happening, then my question becomes, well, what's the trade-off? If we're talking about the effect things have in the black community, we certainly should not ignore that black women are killed, but then we shouldn't condemn or demonize black men for being put in the spotlight on that issue. Similarly, we're not going to say that we're somehow erasing black men from sexual assault or rape charges, even though they're sexually abused and raped at much higher rates than their white male counterparts, just because when we think of that issue, we think of little girls and black women. You see what I'm saying? We don't put that logic on that aspect because we say, well, these people are most affected, so let's attend to the people that we know are affected by this kind of problem. Yet when we talk about black men, somehow there's a zero-sum trade-off, that if we know that black men are dying from homicide and police brutality at such a high rate to black women, that if we focus on black men, that somehow does something or erases the stories of black women. I find that to be an identity politic issue. Now, does that mean that we shouldn't attend to black girls? Absolutely not. We should attend to them. We should put them in context of what happens. But at the same time, we shouldn't erase the kinds of things that happen, like in the Rekia Boyd situation, and talk about Antonio Cross just because he's a black man. Nobody's mentioned Antonio Cross. That was the person that the cop was attempting to shoot. So my question is, are we doing an honest study of what's killing black people, or are we just trying to pick and choose and use statistics for our own needs to push forward the subject that we want? In other words, if I'm a black feminist pushing forward black girls or black women in that case, that's not studying black people. That may get you the political results you want, but that's not understanding what's actually happening in these black communities.
So what's your pushback then for people who say I feel like the plight of black females with regards to how racism, white supremacy, you said it impacts us differently, that the impact that racism, white supremacy has on black females is frequently ignored. It's not given the same type of attention. I even heard some of the folks were saying, you know, the rallies and the response for Michael Brown, that is acceptable, commendable. That's what should happen. Same thing for Eric Garner. Same thing for Ezell Ford. That didn't happen for Renisha McBride. And it's because we don't really have the same value for black female life, black female victims of racism.
But I think, I think that we have to pay attention to the qualitative difference, right? I mean, we got a conviction on Renisha McBride. The guy, here's the difference. Wafer didn't come out and say, he said initially, I was afraid, right? But he couldn't say that, look, I was afraid of a black woman, so I was claiming self-defense, right? Mm-hmm. That didn't fly. But when you get Trayvon Martin or Michael Brown, the idea is that Trayvon Martin used concrete as a weapon. The idea is that Michael Brown, even though he shot six times, one through the head on the top of his head, somehow was charging the officer. Right? It's a completely different logic that people use to motivate that. So then when people make this type of argument, I would simply ask you, well, what is the end result? So if you're saying that we should march and do everything else for, like, Renisha McBride, we got the conviction that you had local organizations, the NAACP, and a great prosecutor knowing that this white man killed this black woman, and they got the conviction. Black men haven't had the opportunity to celebrate a conviction yet. Not in Jordan. Jordan Davis, only his killer was only captured because of the attempted murder on the other two or three gentlemen in the car. He got off for killing Jordan Davis. Trayvon Martin got, George Zimmerman got off, right? You know, now we have Michael Brown, and there's a high likelihood that that Wilson's going to get off. There's a difference. If we're making the argument that we care about justice or whatever this justice system is saying justice is, then I don't see how they can argue with that result. The question about attention doesn't seem to address the fact that black men are not getting the convictions of their killers, and the attention is not stopping black men from dying. So you can say we shouldn't look at it so much, but that doesn't stop the fact that every day that we turn on the TV, another black man is going to be killed, right? And that's what I say is that if this is going to become an argument about the attention to a particular issue, then to me it seems to say that it needs to say, well, what is that attention trying to garner? Because we're getting the convictions on behalf of black women just using Renisha McBride, because there's been other cases where we haven't got it, like Tariqa Wilson, et cetera. But if we're getting that conviction in that case, then why are you upset about marching for a group of people that have not had as many convictions and whose officers are usually not charged? Because what we're talking about here is the difference between a resident and the police state. The government is actually legitimately and legalized killing black men, and they're getting away with it. That seems to be a qualitative difference in how we understand what's going on in the relationship between black women's deaths, which happen at a much lower rate by the police, and black male deaths, which are astronomical by the police.
Context of white supremacy, Dr. Tommy J. Curry, with the events of this summer, I just read your report, and some of the reports you have listed as kind of a work in progress where you might still make some edits, so I don't know if this is one of those is the final, but the eschatological dilemma, the problem of studying the black male only as the deaths that result from anti-black racism. I read it. I thought it was fascinating and extremely relevant to things that are unfolding right now. Before I kind of read a few sections and get your response, just can you give our listeners an overview of what you're trying to do in this piece?
Absolutely, absolutely. And eschatological dilemma is what I'm suggesting is that we have a problem thinking about black men. We only think about black men as their corpses. So even, I mean, Mike Brown is a really good case. We have to look at them only as a dead body, and we don't know anything about their actual life. We see them as dead bodies, and those dead bodies become symbols of some kind of failure or the need for revolt or protest, etc. But they don't have a social life. In other words, we don't know what their aspirations or dreams was. I mean, if you think about the movie Fruitvale Station, right, think about why they made that movie. The idea was to show that Oscar Grant was a complex human being, that he had family, friends, emotions, etc. And it was an attempt to humanize him after he was dead. What I'm suggesting in that piece on eschatological dilemmas is that we have a problem thinking about black men outside of the deaths that we see. And one of the major reasons that I have such an issue with academics, specifically the black feminist interpretation of this issue on black masculinity or even the endangered species argument, is that it's asking us to say, well, look, if people aren't attended to as much, then that says something about the worth of their bodies, rather than saying that if people aren't alive as much, that tells us about the worth of their life. So we have to really have a real honest conversation about what is it that we really value. Is it the case that black men have privilege in their terminology because they get more attention, or is it the case that black men don't have any kind of privilege because they're dead so much? Like, what justifies that? What justifies incarceration? What justifies homicide? What justifies police brutality to the extent that we have, where we can make the kind of argument that says that black male life is valued more than someone else's in this society? So in that piece, I really try to bring that up and try to say that, look, we don't have a real way to talk about the value of black male life, be it in the academy or in society, and we only value them for symbols, either their dead body and how we get to use that for whatever our politics are going to be, or then as the, you know, celebrity, athlete, etc., right? We see black men as caricatures. We don't really pay attention to their violence, and in the most part, we ignore the sexual violence and sexual brutality they suffer in this society. We reserve things like rape only for the female body. Well, when we talk about the rape of black men in foster care, we talk about the rape of black men on public streets by police during stop and frisk, or we talk about the rape of black men during slavery, all those things are ignored.
Particularly the last portion that you touched on with regards to ignoring sexual violence against black males, black boys. We just had a former prisoner in Pennsylvania, Yusuf Anthony. He's mm-hmm. the subject of Alan Hornblum's book, Sentenced to Science, where he talks about where they gave him a few nickels to do these studies that basically ruined his health and gave him lifelong debilitating health problems. In addition to that, he talks about how these studies, because they would pay them, I think, like maybe $35 to participate in these studies, that you ended up having a pool of inmates who had a considerable amount of cash that they could either bribe guards so that they could get access to a preferred inmate that they wanted to rape, and or the guards could then participate right. in all this and rape people and say, hey, if you want to be on this study or if you want to get certain privileges, let me take advantage of you sexually. And he talks about how this was rampant. It just was a core aspect of his daily experience, seeing people being raped or seeing people being pimped, seeing guards raping and taking sexually exploiting oh, yeah. black inmates. And it reminded me so much when I began reading this portion of your paper. I want to read this portion and then kind of get you to comment. And sure. this is under the subheading, The Sexual Violence Ignored, Racism's Sodomizing of Black Men and Boys. You write, the sexual violence of black men and boys has remained a routine aspect of racial violence. In our everyday lives, black men are publicly assaulted sexually and exposed to the sexual coercion of the police state. But their stories and these public displays of racism's sexual component is an unapproachable study under our current disciplinary arrangement of knowledge, specifically the gender category itself. On January 7th, 2014, Darren Manning, a 16-year-old black boy, Pennsylvania, unless my memory's in error, was castrated by a female police officer that found him suspicious. Mr. Manning was a child, a straight-A student. He was searched, patted down, and then his testicles were squeezed by this woman of the state so hard that they ruptured, as indicated by an audible popping. This is not as uncommon as one might think. Young black males are constantly subjected to sexual assault and coercion by their daily encounters with the state. In the seclusion created on the street through police interrogations and under the aegis of the now unconstitutional surveillance practice known as stop and frisk. On August 9, 1997, Abner Louima, a Haitian man, was sexually assaulted by Officer Justin Volp in a Brooklyn police station. Louima was arrested for allegedly striking Volp in a crowd. Once transported to the police station, Louima was forced into a bathroom where Volp grabbed his testicles, kicked him in the groin, and then anally penetrated him with a bathroom plunger. Showing no remorse, or rather the sexual etiquette of the police state towards black men, he paraded the plunger around the station as proof of his conquest. On August 28, 2004, Coprez Kofi was stopped by officers Scott Corhoen and Gerald Lodwich. In an effort to find drugs, Officer Corhoen stuck a screwdriver in Kofi's anus. Even when white officers assault other non-white peoples, there is an association with the sexual violence committed by the police with black men. Angel Perez was raped into submitting to be an informant. In October of 2012, the Chicago police sodomized him with a pistol, with one officer yelling, "I hear that a big black nigger dick feels like a gun up your ass, end quote. The sexual violence of the police is not isolated to the act of sodomy. The fear that white men have had of the black rapist, the mythical beast conjured within the white imagination to justify lynching, also serves as a justification for violence against black men. On September 16, 2013, the white state replied to a 911 call of a white woman fearful of a black man asking for help at her doorstep after surviving a car accident. Her fear of this black man named Jonathan Farrell led to his murder by the white men of the state. I'll stop there. I just remembered as I was reading, Eric Garner had filed many reports saying that he was being harassed by enforcement officials, white officers. In one of those reports, he said that the officer stuck his finger up his anus in the middle of the street, broad daylight, while people were walking by, searching for, I have no idea what, maybe a loose cigarette, untaxed tobacco product, where they're missing out on some funds. Can you just kind of talk about how this gets ignored while in the same context you have this hypersexualization that black males are just looking to rape any and everything that moves, particularly white women?
Yeah, I mean, look, this is, you know, as I've said before, this is the problem of using, you know, disciplinary categories to talk about reality, right? And, you know, when we, I mean, I've had a hard time trying to even get this kind of information out in the university because no one wants to talk about black men being victims of rape. Because when you talk about that, then you unearth this history where white women now become involved, where you start seeing that white men didn't only rape black women, but they raped black men too. So there's a homoeroticism involved. You now have to deal with identity politics where black feminists feel like they're losing, you know, some cachet on the rape category. I've had several conversations where, you know, black feminists have accused me of taking rape away from black women because because I'm bringing forth this evidence. So, I mean, that's the one thing that people aren't aware of. It. People don't want to speak about black men and boys as being subject to rape. The other part about it is that we only see black men and boys in terms of a racist and a rapist ontology, right? So we see them under the myth of the black rapist, meaning that we only see them as being the perpetrators of sexual violence, not the victims of it, right? So when we look at issues about the woman who was the 70-year-old foster woman who had raped several black boys under her care, right, we don't think of black women or white women as being capable of raping people. We read Anton Fisher's, you know, memoir, you know, and we hear him talk about it, but we still don't want to accept it. We want to say that those are outliers, that has nothing to do with what's happening in our communities. But the reality of the situation is that does. And I think that part of it is that we see such real vulnerabilities around black men, right? And just think about this. We know that we have a criminal justice system that will convict black men for basically anything, right? If they steal money, they can get life sentences. If they are, you know, standing on the street and the police, you know, accost them, if they defend themselves or speak up for themselves, they end up dead. This is a societal vulnerability. So that means that black men are not only powerless, they cannot even be recognized for that vulnerability. So they have no power to do anything to anyone outside of, you know, a physical assault. But then even that notion that they will physically assault people is enough to get a stereotype and implicit bias activation to kill black men as to where they stand. So when you have issues of rape, people are like, well, this is something we don't talk about. This doesn't happen. Men can't be raped. And certainly black men, who have historically been the rapist of every type of woman on earth, allegedly, can't be victims of this type of violence. They're the ones that cause it. They're the ones that do it. They're the ones that we have to lynch because that's what's going on. So when you have this conversation in society, nobody in the university and even in our own communities, because we don't do a good job talking about homosexuality, especially homosexual abuse in our communities, don't want to have the conversation of men raping other men. And then when we have the conversation about women doing it, now we have all these kind of masculine tropes that suggest that men can't be raped, that if a man raped somebody, he was a punk or he was weak or he wanted it. These are the kinds of explanations we have. So we're not even at ground zero in terms of having a conversation that admits that this is a possibility, much less having theoretical explanations to explain why this happens so often to young black men and boys. So that's a real difficulty. And the problem with that is that it in many ways lets the specific types of sexual violence against black men go unattended to. So Darren Manning, for instance, and found out that he only had a blood clot, that it didn't completely rupture the testicle, right? But what do we have to explain that? Because we don't think women can really assault men, but this female police officer squares him, you know, squares his testes, he had a blood clot, he was clearly in pain, you know, there was some trauma to the area. What do we say about that? Right, what do we say about the Kofi situation? What do we say about Garner, where we have this constant sodomization of black men by police? Right, what do we say to these young boys? We don't have theoretical explanations. All we can say is it happens. Whereas when we talk about other groups, if you talk about white women being raped, we have patriarchy, we have the Duluth model, we have all kind of theories of masculinization and domination that talks about why men rape women. If you're talking about black feminists, you have intersectionality, talk about what the specific argument in the eroticization or the eroticism involved with white men raping black women, or even the pathology of black men trying to rape black women because they're trying to really be men. But you put that same thing in black men, suddenly the conversation goes dead, because we don't have a theoretical argument. We don't have any way to explain it. You see what I'm saying? So we have to do better. And this is what I mean even when I'm talking about these issues of comparison about who gets more attention. There's a clear lack of arguments about black men that we can theoretically access to explain their condition. We can talk about them being dead all day. We could talk about them not graduating high school all day. We could talk about them being locked up all day, but we don't have any explanation outside of, well, that's racist. But when every other group gets raped, they have a very specific theory. You talk about black women, you have black feminism, you have intersectionality, you have, you know, matriarchy, you have all kind of theories that explain why that exists and matters. When you talk about black men, you don't have that kind of explanation. And the effect of that is exactly as you're seeing in that paper, that most people don't even know about those issues, right? And I mean, and one of the other things that really upsets me is, you know, in a few paragraphs down, I talk about the issue in Joliet, where you had a group of white people promised sex to these two young black men, and they actually killed them, cut their bodies up, and then had an orgy on top of it, on top of their two dead bodies, right, on top of those two gentlemen. And what frustrated me so much, and I just kind of waited for this, I asked myself, is any black feminist blog or feminist blog going to pick this up? Are they going to pick up a case of necrophilia where two black men were specifically killed just to fill out a racist necrophobic fantasy? Or necrophilic fantasy, and not one to this very day has. So that tells me something about both the attention we have to those types of issues, as well as to what we want, what kind of meanings we want to assign to it. We don't really care, as an academy, people really don't really care about what's happening to black people on the ground. What they do is translate that pain based on their theories to show that their theories are right. And what that does for them, just like you see on Twitter since the Ferguson situation happens, is it makes them seem like they're prophets. They get to now say, look, I've always championed this theory, and look how my theory is great because it explains X, Y, and Z. Whereas what I'm trying to say is that these theories are stupid because they can't attend to things like black male rape. They can't explain things like why Rekia Boyd gets shot in the middle of them trying to shoot Antonio Cross. Because we're trying to figure out why these specific people are oppressed, why the black females are oppressed, or the black, you know, gay male or black gay woman's oppressed, instead of saying, well, look, there's a structure that all these people live in, a society that everyone lives in, that's being affected in different ways because of their bodies on white supremacy. My focus is on white supremacy and the effect that white supremacy has on populations, not the fact that we're trying to create special types of oppressions that we can't test or see and just say exist based on experience, right? Gender is an accumulation of different ills. It doesn't mean that something's unique to it. There's no such thing as unique oppression, but you get the accumulation of certain types of things, like death and incarceration for black men, or maybe sexual assault and abuse for little black girls, right? Those things accumulate. It doesn't mean that one thing doesn't happen to the other. Black girls and black women are incarcerated just like black men and boys are raped. We're talking about a matter of degree here. We're not talking about the propensity for something to actually exist. And I think that we have a hard time getting our minds around something like that.
That portion was coming up next. I wanted to read that and then ask about Thomas A. Foster, I believe, is a white male who has written about this. I know you cite his work, and you mentioned him when you were with us last time.
Yes.
The paragraph continued, the state is not the only perpetrator of sexual violence against black men and boys. Trayvon Martin's death has been covered by intellectuals, media pundits, criminal justice experts, and social justice activists for the last year exclusively as a narrative of race-based violence. While it is nonetheless true that Trayvon Martin's death has served as a grim reminder of anti-black violence, there has not been one article, blog, or public conversation dealing with the possibility of Martin being sexually assaulted by Zimmerman, despite Rachel Gentile announcing to the American public that she told Trayvon Martin that Zimmerman could have been a pedophile. On January 10, 2013, in Joliet, Illinois, two young black men were strangled by four white assailants. Two white women and two white men killed Eric Glover and Terrence Rankin, surfed their bodies, and then had a threesome on top of their corpses. This story has received little national coverage and to this day remains untouched by the literature or problematized as a racist act of necrophilia. Again, Thomas A. Foster, he has several pieces which kind of deal with this. One, the sexual abuse of black men under American slavery, and he is a white male. I don't know if you've had correspondence with him directly, but
I have not.
Oh, okay. I was gonna see if he's had the same sort of pushback where people are saying they don't want to talk about this, or why are you doing this? Maybe you should do some other forms of work. I'm gonna try and see if we can get him on the program to discuss this piece and some of his other literature. But you're saying that people have, when you have brought these issues up, people have either had nothing to say or have they actually tried to discourage you from exploring?
Oh, absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely. I mean, there's actually a video on YouTube where I read this very paper that's up on academia. You know, and a black feminist decided to boo me. You know, she said, "Oh, this erases black women," and you know, again, this is that zero sum logic, right? I mean, I don't find anything offensive about studying black women because they're part of the black community. We've been studying black women for God 40 years. You know, and I think, again, this is what I mean when I talk about the caricatures of black thought. We pretend that somehow black women only began being studied when, you know, with the Combahee River Collective, right? But you have generations. I mean, you have Joyce Ladner's dissertation that was written in the 60s. You have Frances Rogers Rose. I mean, you know, you have Allison Edwards, who wrote a scathing piece against Susan Brown Miller's, book on rape and, you know, Michelle Wallace's book, The Black Macho. But she's completely erased from history, right? She was kicking it with the Sojourner Truth organization in the late 70s. I mean, you have all these black women who've been very adamant defenders, and we're not even talking about the, you know, historical activists or anything like this, but actual women who have produced literatures surrounding black women at the same time that black feminism was coming about, and they're completely erased from history for one kind of narrative. So then when you have a black male come up and say, we need to study black boys, then you get these same kind of caricatures of the position. Oh, well, we focus enough on black men. You know, we've already done that. We know all we need to know about black men. And I asked him a very simple question. Look, the Black Power Movement, which you say, you know, centered black men, lasted at best for 10 or 15 years. We've been having black feminism in the university for the last 40. And you're telling me that there's no need to study black men simply on what basis? That 10 to 15 years outweighs 40 years of actual scholarly production? This is ridiculous, right? These are the ideological tropes that we use in the academy to justify what we think. This is the commodification of allegedly radical language that we now call intersectional or feminist under these, you know, and we value them as if they're somehow insightful when they miss the larger picture of what's happening in our communities. We talk about domestic violence, but we don't talk about bidirectional violence, where black women actually attack black men and black men escalate. We don't talk about sexual molestation of infants. We don't talk about infanticide. We don't talk about any of these things because they don't fit with the at-large ideological program at university. My work is just some of that does that. It doesn't fit with the at-large narrative, and I'm fine with that because my interest is actually studying black people. So that means that, you know, you don't get to pick a side. You know what I mean? Sometimes you find things where black men abuse black women. You find things where black women abuse black men. You found alcoholism, drug abuse, incarceration, molestation, sexual abuse, juvenile. You find all kind of problems in our community. And you don't get to hide behind some magical theory as if it makes one person safe. And that's why I do the work that I do. So in this case, when I'm writing about these black men are the victims. If I'm writing a different paper, they may not become the victims. They actually commit crimes. And then we have to find out, well, why do they commit the crimes, right? It's an actual study. I don't come to it with a predestined answer and then read everything just to get to that answer. And I think that that's the difference. When we study black men, most people have an answer. They're oppressive, they're rapists, they're violent, they're, you know, patriarchal. When I study black men, I say, let me find out why they exhibit these types of things. Let me find out how you can say that a black man's a patriarch, but then he has no power to prevent himself from being killed or molested in his own communities, right? It's a completely different approach to the way that we value and study black life.
Again, Dr. Tommy J. Curry, Context of White Supremacy, kind of pulling this back contemporary issues. The line you have, I thought this was just great sentence, because black men die, and black men are decentered as the normative subject of thinking, there's a collective forgetting that collapses them to their corpses and not their activity. That has definitely been on display this summer, day after day after day. Eric Garner all the way through with these. And I even kind of talked about that I feel this happens all the time. Michael Brown Jr., Eric, whichever one, this happens on a daily basis. And some people even ask, because of that, why is the Michael Brown situation getting so much attention when Ezell Ford is not getting nearly that much attention? And John Crawford, mm-hmm. I think a lot of people don't even know who that is.
No, they don't know about the brother.
The black male that got shot in
shot
a Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
He had a BB gun in his hand. The police thought somebody called, said it was a real gun. He was on the phone as well. It wasn't like he was just walking around threatening people. He was on the phone with his girlfriend. They shot him and killed him in the Walmart. But to me, it almost, I said yesterday, it seems like racial theater. Like we kind of enjoy this almost as reality TV where we can sit back and people can take sides. They can pitch in and donate money. They can name call Al Sharpton for a few days and either they'll have a trial or they won't. And then it disappears and we just go on about our business. But it seems like this summer to me feels like the epitome of what you just said in terms of collapsing black male life into corpses, not their lived activity.
Well, it's funny. I was writing an article. Well, I was working on an article actually before I called in, and you know, I called it "The Theaters of Racial Genocide."
Wow.
Right. And this is the problems that we have is that, you see, we've adopted a situation, or the black public has become victim to black bourgeois academics who have adopted a way of reading them in terms of morality and not in terms of what their actual problems are. So when you have something like Ferguson happen, you have all these black academics that are on social media rushing to be part of this because they want their time in the spotlight. Whereas my point is, look, we need to comment on this, but we need to do our jobs, which is studying it. Where academics are not activists in the same way that lawyers are going to be activists and grassroots activists are activists. Just because we read a lot of books doesn't mean that we actually know how to organize people on the ground. Now, some of us do, and that's good for us that we have that talent, but not every academic is going to be a natural-born leader. That's the pretense that comes along with thinking that somehow you've mastered white theory, now you can also master black bodies, right? What I'm trying to do is suggest to people is that, look, this is not a pretend situation. This is something that if we truly believed in, then everything we write should be about these black bodies. And in my case, I'm writing about these black male bodies. But when you do that, when you make that kind of statement that says, I'm not getting off of this ground because I believe that black men and the deaths of black men affect black families and black women and black mothers and black children, people have a problem with that because now you've kind of excluded people. So you don't really care about what black feminists think. You don't really care about what white liberals think because for you, none of those people really affect what the project is. They're not contributing to how we understand the deaths of these black men. I care about scholars who are invested in saying, okay, look, I'm a social worker. I'm dealing with this. What's your theory? Right? And they tell me their studies and their findings. I tell them my theory. They say, okay, well, look, that seems like a good idea. Here's how we can use it. That's what I'm interested in doing. So what we get to do now because we have Facebook and Twitter is we get to play like we're, you know, a participant in this theater of genocide. We don't study the genocide. We just say, well, we'll talk about it today. And you mark my word. After this Ferguson thing passes, they're going to do another piece. I guarantee it that problematizes everything that's happening around Ferguson. Again, saying that black men are getting all the attention. And the reason I know this happens is because they did the same thing to Trayvon Martin, comparing it to Renisha McBride, and they did the same thing for Eric Garner, saying we're willing to march for Eric Garner. And Eric Garner hasn't really gotten that much attention, right? Like he's got, you know, they did the march in his city, but they did the same thing for Renisha McBride. There was a vigil of 200 or 300 people that showed up for Renisha McBride. Black communities organize around the people they lose in their communities, be it man or woman. But the Academy is the one that tries to say, well, we didn't see them come out in force like we did for Trayvon Martin, so that means they don't care about people. But none of these people are attending to what's happening in these communities. Every day I'll get up, I'll read and see, you know, what's going on. That's how I knew about the Crawford cat, you know, who he was talking to on the phone. And the fact that they just released the video and it shows that he didn't do anything wrong whatsoever. But he doesn't get much attention. Most people don't even know about him, right? But no, we make up this pretend story that says every black man who dies gets attention. I mean, the report, they did a report a year ago, and it said like 300 black men have been shot, 4 black women have been shot by police, and of those 300 people, we only know maybe 6 people's names, right? How does that show us that we value black male life? How does it show us that when we don't want to write stories or articles or research, or we don't even want to talk about these people publicly, that that somehow means that we value black life more than others? That's not us valuing it. That's us disgracing it. Right, it's just disgracing the fact that because black men don't fit into the theories, the disciplines, and the pop culture kind of activism that we have in the academy right now, that they don't fit in any of that, they don't make us unpopular. Right, that's not us showing that we value their lives more than other people, and that's a real problem that we have to deal with. And that's why I'm always urging the black public to be extremely suspicious of black academics that come through like they have a panacea for everybody's problems. As if you become black and Christian, or you become black and feminist, or become a black liberal progressive, that somehow that solves all the issues of white supremacy. White supremacy doesn't care about what you say. It doesn't care. You can't scare it off by yelling at it, because it has a police force. It has a military. It owns people's jobs in the academy. So this stuff that I see on Twitter and Facebook and all these other things where people are talking real radical, they know that's not going to do anything. What does stuff is exactly what's going on at Ferguson right now. And what I'm saying is that we're unprepared. We're unprepared to deal with a military force in a police, and you know, based on police. We don't have a mindset to deal with militarized police. And that's what we need to talk about. We don't have strategies to deal with that. Because this isn't like the protests of the 1960s. They have drones, they have tanks, they have military artillery. We need to have a real conversation. And I don't have all the answers to that kind of question, but I'm saying that needs to be the theater that we're really interested in. Instead of performing these tricks on social media, we need to say, well, look, we need to have a conference about the militarization of black communities and how black communities or black academics can respond or tie into people or specialists who know how to deal with this.
Definitely want to hear some of your thoughts on that. I just, before I get to that, I number one, encourage any of the folks that are listening in, if you have questions for Dr. Curry, the number to dial is 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-POUND. Press star 6 if you have a question for Dr. Curry. You were talking about black professors or black folks who are in the ivory tower, the academy, and their response to Ferguson, and even from your tweet earlier and saying, are they really willing to put their career on the line to offer some real solutions that can be implemented, practical things that black people can do in response to having this military might of racism, white supremacy in their neighborhood, rolling by their house, and addressing the seriousness of black death, particularly black males, black boys, being killed, slaughtered on a daily basis where people don't even know their names most of the time. In the same paper at the bottom, you reference one of my favorites, E. Franklin Frazier, and his analysis of this, which I wanted to share and just to kind of get your comment on briefly, where he writes, sometimes I think that the failure of the American Negro intellectual to grasp the nature and the significance of these experiences is due to the fact that he continues to be unconscious, an unconscious victim of these experiences. After an African intellectual met a group of Negro intellectuals, he told me that they were really men who were asleep. All of this only tends to underline the fact that educated Negroes or Negro intellectuals have failed to achieve any intellectual freedom. In fact, with few exceptions of literary men, it appears that the Negro intellectual is unconscious of the extent to which his thinking is restricted to sterile repetition of the safe and conventional ideas current in American society. This is attributable in part, of course, to the conditions under which an educated and intellectual class emerged in the American society. This class emerged as the result of white American philanthropy, although the situation has changed and the Negro intellectuals are supported through other means, they are still largely dependent upon the white community. There is no basis of economic support for them within the Negro community, and where there is economic support within the Negro community, it demands conformity to conservative and conventional ideas. Again, E. Franklin Frazier, the failure of the Negro intellectual. That even reminded me of Dr. Welsing saying she was denied tenure at Howard University for discussing white supremacy.
Yeah.
If this is still the case, unfortunately, in 2014, that these black intellectuals, that they are fearful that they might upset someone in their department who might say, hey, well, you're not going to get tenure, or we're going to even let you go if you're an associate professor, would it be logical to say, well, We just will not expect them to do anything that's going to disrupt white people, so we probably won't have too much regard for a lot of what these people offer. Would that be logical?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, if you this stuff happens, right? It happens. It's not something that's just theoretical. People write what they write so that they can get accepted and get tenure. They write and say what they have to say or will say so they can be put in women and gender studies programs instead of being put in Africana studies programs, because you generally get paid more and they have more financial support at some institutions. Well, actually at most public state institutions, right? So this isn't, you know, it's not like black scholars or the black intelligentsia are walking around saying, I'm just going to speak the truth. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It's them saying that I'm going to speak about what I know is the most popular and current so that I can be in the crowd and I can get, you know, my invitations to conferences and tenure and, you know, all the perk benefits. You know, it's like I tell people, it's like, did we wake up one morning and we just think that suddenly all the black people who study race and racism happen to be progressive liberals, and that every black woman who comes through programs in philosophy or through the humanities, et cetera, just happen to be a black feminist? That doesn't even make sense. Like, we don't come from populations. Like, feminism and liberalism is not the keystone or cornerstones of our black communities that we originate from. So what would it take to take a whole bunch of people, many of whom are still first generation, into a university and completely give them ideas and research agendas that have nothing to do with how they were raised, their communities they come from, or what they saw in those communities? I mean, we need to pay attention to that. It's not an accident that these people are putting forward these types of ideas, and that these ideas happen to be the ones, this is Fabio Rojas's work, right, you know, happen to be the ones that have been funded and mostly rewarded through things like the Ford Fellowship or endowments from Carnegie, et cetera. Right, it's this focus on discourse, high theory, intersectionality, et cetera, that gets rewarded. It's not the focus on white supremacy, material conditions, economics, and imperialism. You know, that's just the reality of the world we live in. So it's no shocker that you have people gravitating towards what we consider to be high theory or progressive theory instead of real material analysis dealing with the history and political consequences of black people.
Hmm. If you are a black person, male or female, and you're coming through the academy, if you reject, and you make it known that you reject intersectionality or gay rights, if you reject feminism, you reject some of these more popular theories, and you're a black person,
yes,
you want to study racism, is that going to make your career a lot more difficult?
Well, it's not going to make you unpopular. You know, so unless you know the right people or you know the right, you know, the kind of department you're trying to go into, then it could certainly damage your career. You know, when I came into it, I really didn't care because I was going to law school. So I had more of a flippant attitude because I was, you know, I was like, these theories don't hold up. Like, you can't test them. You know, for me, I'm a real big stickler about whether or not I can apply a theory to a situation or context without having to censor or eliminate things from the context to make the theory work. So in the case of something like intersectionality, I ask the question, well, if intersectionality works, then why do we assume that black men have this certain type of privilege over black women, where when we test it, we don't see it, right? And this was actually a recent piece by Matua, where she was talking about multidimensionality as to intersectionality, as to black men, what intersectionality was, feminism or something, you know, an article like that, where she actually says, look, I'm grappling with the very same issue. And she gets this from Darren Hutchinson's argument about multidimensionality in 2000. And the basic argument is that, look, if you actually test race and gender on men, you find that they have huge problems with employment, racial profiling by police, education, matriculation, disease, and incarceration. So they're saying that, look, it doesn't fit to say that they're absolutely privileged in this intersectional frame. When you actually study them, you don't find that same type of privilege, right? So to me, that's a huge breaking point for the theory. You can't just say black men are privileged and start off with that assumption when I can't test that in society. Similarly, it doesn't mean that I can say that black women are always absolutely disadvantaged. There are going to be certain disadvantages that black women have next to black men, and there are going to be certain advantages because we live in societies that are diverse and complex, right? So we may be able to talk about income where black men who have the same degree earn 6 cents more on average versus black men who are not who have no employment. So the people who are unemployed don't have an advantage to the black female, but the people who are employed to have the same education do. So she's disadvantaged to this group that has the same education, but she's certainly advantaged to the other one. Life is a complex thing. you know, but these theories don't capture that. You know, same thing with black feminism. I just think the history is debunked. I mean, you can look at, I mean, if you consider that black men have been raped during slavery, if you consider things like, you know, the Williametta Hawkins issue with Willie McGee, where a black man was raped by a white woman during the Civil Rights Movement in the 1940s or 50s, and it had a huge, you know, it was a huge blow up. He inevitably was killed, and compared that to Recy Taylor, then you're like, well, look, the history is complex. This wasn't an issue where black men didn't care about black women being raped. This is an issue where black people actually saw sexual abuse as part of the Civil Rights Movement, right? That's the Danielle McGuire's book, At the Dark End of the Street. So you have all these histories that are so complicated and complex that we just don't know about, but we form theories based on our ignorance and not based on our historical acuity or research into these areas. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't talk about black women being raped. It doesn't mean we shouldn't talk about economic discrimination or domestic abuse, whatever the case may be, but it means that we can't put one fixed causality like all people who abuse are just men. That's just not true. Right, we have abuse within, you know, queer gay couples. We have abuse in lesbian couples. We have abuse in transsexual couples. There's abuse all around. There's women that abuse men. So if you're using a Duluth model that says that only men abuse because they're men, then I'm asking, well, what happens in all the other scenarios? What explanation do we have? Right, and this is what I mean when I say that I think that political ideologies have become moralities that have stood in for black studies. We're not interested in scholars that actually question or worry about problems like black death. We're not interested in what causes something like Ferguson. We're just interested in how we could get hashtag after hashtag to say, oh, well, intersectionality, you know, or why we can't wait, or whatever the hashtag of the day is. But none of that tells us concretely about dealing with issues. And I'll give you a real good example about this. All the arguments that have been going around with My Brother's Keeper, you know, talking about black men and why black women are in similar situations, which we, you know, don't, refute. One of the things they've been using is this insight study. And they've been citing this one figure that talks about, you know, black women's worth collectively is $100, black men's is like $6,000. When you actually read the study, it says, well, one of the reasons that this exists amongst women of color, not just black women, but women of color, is that women generally have higher revolving debt and they don't own as much. So where black men own their car, they own their home, that's what attributes to their wealth. And when you talk about My Brother's Keeper, you say, well, look, at the end of the Insight article, they say that we need to do things like strengthen TAF programs, and we need to make sure that women are getting a foothold in owning businesses and make sure that they're doing debt reduction programs, right? How does My Brother Keeper extending that to black women change any of the recommendations they have from the own study that they're citing the material from? And this is what I mean when I say that people aren't seriously studying black people. The people who did the study told to the recommendations. It doesn't say just getting more black women or what they're actually fighting about is money. Getting more philanthropists to fund black women to study black girls to translate into policy, you know, recommendations. None of that deals with the issue. In fact, that's a 10-20 year long strategy, you know, by most cases. So it's not that they care about the people. They care about the recognition and the money that comes from studying the people. And they have no proof that it's going to increase the wealth or the recommendation will increase the wealth. In fact, most of the people that criticize haven't given a different recommendation, right? What we need to do is specific studies, right? Okay, well, black men have this problem. We don't think My Brother's Keeper is going to work because it doesn't address X, Y, and Z. Let's put together a program about black women. Here's their problems, right? The problems, they don't get jobs. They don't, you know, they have high debt and they don't own businesses. Let's target that. But nobody wants to do that because they want the recognition of attacking My Brother's Keeper and Obama's X, Y, and Z, right? That's the problem we have. And the same thing happens with black death. Black people die. We don't talk about why black people die. We don't talk about what makes them vulnerable to death. We don't talk about, you know, circumstances. They've died. Let's start a Twitter war. Let's start hashtags. Let's activate black Twitter. Let me come out on top of that. And now, you know, we get to say, hey, I'm on the bandwagon. I'm one of the most radical people. But at the same time, we have some people that were celebrating the For Harriet piece talking about why she wouldn't march for Eric Garner. Because, you know, black men didn't support the criticism of My Brother's Keeper, and they don't support black women generally. So what we do is we use these black men's lives, and we weigh them against our own personal politics. Well, if enough black men didn't do what I said, then I'm not going to march for that black man. And this is what I mean when I say that we've internalized a lot of the white supremacist logics about how we value black life. We don't look at black life as absolute, that it should never be extinguished. We look at black life as something that's contingent based on how I feel or based on my politics. And that's a very dangerous situation to be in. You don't see white people saying, well, they killed the liberal, so we don't care. Black people say they killed a white person, so this black person should be executed first and foremost. And the reason they do that is because they have a very real consciousness about white supremacy and racial solidarity, because they know that it's not about their politics, it's about the fact that you killed a white person. And if black people believe that it's safe to kill white people, because that means that they, it fundamentally affects them because they could be next. But you see black people getting killed in the streets one after the other. Black men being killed in the streets as young, you know, kids, man, kids, like teenagers, kids. And then we're up in the university arguing, well, I don't know if I should support that one because that person didn't have good grades or that person didn't really do X, Y, Z or that person has a criminal history, right? We make it contingent. We still believe in the respectability of black bodies, and then we come out in public and say, well, we don't really buy that. But then we write articles and say, yay, because the person said that, you know, this person or this black person or black men in general didn't support their politics, so I'm not going to march for this person. It's completely ridiculous. It's completely ridiculous. We have a war that is going on black life, a war that didn't just start in this century, a war that's been going on since the elimination of slavery and in the birth of the convict lease system through Reconstruction. And that's a war that we're losing because we're a colonized people in the United States. And as much as we want to pretend that we're not, we can't answer why Trayvon Martin or an Eric Gordon or Jordan Davis or, you know, a Mike Brown keeps happening. We can't answer that, right? All we get to do is say, you know, we hope that one day white people will change and recognize our humanity. When the reality of the situation is most of the white people that join the police force are coming from these lower economic communities that's surrounded by Ferguson and have a high level of racial aversion. You're not going to change those people. And that's what George Jackson understood. That's what the Black Panthers understood. That you can blame black men for not being progressive on gender, but you have to recognize that the patriarchal structure, which is about violence, specifically targets black men's precisely because they would use violence against it. You can't talk about love when your oppressor has no moral consciousness. And this is something that Asada herself recognized. Bell Hooks likes to always masculinize this. Well, that's just black men aiming to be patriarchs. But even Asada says that you can't rationalize or talk about love with your oppressor. She shared the same sentiment. So we're in a reality right now where this liberal progressivism is being tested against the reality of the fact that white people crave and are obsessed with the visions and the realities of black male death specifically. And until we come to recognize that reality, then we're simply going to remain victims of the same kind of genocidal logics that we've been victims to. That's why the government decided to destroy the Black Power movement. Right, because it understood that it was organizing sentiments and sentimentality with other oppressed people around the world, in Asia, the Caribbean, etc. Right, so it took a government program to infiltrate it and to squash it and to assassinate, exile, and kill its leaders. If we're talking about the same kind of liberal progressive reformism that we have in black feminism, then why didn't the government destroy that? Because it moved those people into the academy. All those activists are in the academy. All those activists are celebrity intellectuals that get paid $40,000 and $50,000 to give speeches. So if we're to believe that black feminism was the outgrowth of this and was just as radical, why didn't COINTELPRO or the CIA attack those programs as well, that activism as well? See, we buy into false histories and then ask ourselves how these false histories don't blind us to the fact that certain people keep dying. And that's the sadness of the thing. It's not like this is new. Black men and black women have been dying for 100 years based on the same kind of cause. But we distract ourselves with big words like intersectionality or deconstruction because we don't want to deal with the realities of black death. We'll talk about it as long as it proves our theory, but we don't want to talk about it insofar as it refutes our theory. We don't want to talk about it refuting the potential for discourse to work. We don't want to talk about it as proving that white people have no consciousness or sensibilities towards black life, and they certainly don't care about black death. And until we make that kind of recognition and start doing work on that, right, like E. Franklin Frazier, how is it that you're unconscious and blind to the very things around you? How can African intellectuals come to America and tell you, you just don't get it? You're interested more in increasing your profit within a civil rights structure that gives you money rather than understanding that black people are dying and the real issue is colonialism. We don't get that. So we just keep creating and inventing these imaginary debates as we're arguing with each other and then saying that this has real, you know, reality to the world in front of us without paying attention to the people who are actually concretely dying.
Ashe. I see the folks dialed in. I want to get their
Absolutely.
I want to make sure I got the correct paper. You said Athena Matua. Is it The Multidimensional Turn, Revisiting Progressive Black Masculinities? Is that the paper you referenced?
No. Was it published in 2003 or 2013?
Let's see. There's a date on it. I'm not seeing a date off top. I'm not seeing a date when it was published.
Okay.
The one that you're talking about was published in 2013?
Yeah, it was 2012 or 2013. I forgot the exact date. It's something like multidimensionality is to intersectionality, what, you know, something on that.
Okay. I'll check again, see if I can find it. All
right.
the person, I'm a tad confused. So, you know, if you have a question for Dr. Curry, we can get that. Just make sure you dial in again. The number is 760-569-7676. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you have a question for Dr. Curry. Seems some of the folks are dealing. That was one of the questions I had. One of the listeners said, number one, how do we deal with militarized police, seeing that we are outgunned, out-tanked, out-tear-gassed by racism, white supremacy? That was question one.
Mm-hmm. Well, is that one for me, or?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So, look, you know, I'm not a military strategist, and that's why I said that we need to bring in actual specialists that do this stuff. But what I suggest is that we can't keep telling people they should protest when we know that is going to put them in danger. And I know I've seen blog after blog, post after post talking about, well, you know, rioting is, you know, justified X, Y, and Z. And I completely agree. I mean, people are going to riot to express their discontent, their disdain for a society. But I'm saying that in an anti-black white supremacist society, some of those liberal notions that we have based on the Constitution may not hold up. Right? It's just like when Smiley came on and said every black person should carry a gun after Trayvon Martin. What lawyers are we training specifically to deal with those types of issues? Because you know they're going to convict black people, or they're going to kill them saying that they were coming at them with a gun. If we're going to have these strategies, then we need to make sure that we have the people ready to defend them. It's the same thing they did in the Civil Rights Movement. You didn't just put students on the street and you didn't have any lawyers ready to bail them out. Right? We're disorganized. We don't have a global strategy. We just pick whatever happens and then we just champion it as if it's some kind of somehow revolutionary. We need people that are actually been in the military, people that know about this technology. We have ex-Marine. We have all kind of people that go to the Army, the Marines, etc. We need to tap into some people in our community if we're serious about trying to confront this force.
Okay. Next question. This one was written in. That earlier when you were talking about in doing your scholarship and not being concerned about if people are upset with you or they don't like the view that you've taken, you said, well, if I go in and I say that I'm not really concerned about what white liberals think about me or black feminists think about me, listener said that she felt you were classifying, putting black females in the same category with white liberals, racist suspects. And is that correct? Would that be logical in a system of white supremacy to have black females?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, I mean, let me just give her I'm assuming it's a young woman that asked the question. I don't think all black women are equal to white liberals, but I think that you should be able to compare this. I mean, Fanon's done this. Is the national bourgeoisie. This is how, you know, the Black Panthers talk about bourgeois black people. There are certain classes of black people in society, just as there are certain classes of black people within the academy that buy into white supremacist logics. So that means that just as I have a black male who believes that racism is gone or that we can solve everything through discourse and dialogical reasoning and has no interest in anti-black death, that person perpetuates a certain type of white logics, especially in terms of how they define themselves as good versus a black radical or anti-colonialist who is bad. The same way I would argue that there are certain brands of black feminism who very much fall into this kind of this same type of neoliberal articulation, meaning that they use their identity as a black female in recognition of that against the black community at large, both by saying that the black community at large is homophobic, anti-progressive, don't really get it, or the black male that they compete with for the job or for recognition is a patriarch, etc. Right? So I do think there are black people that fall victim to perpetuating or assimilating or internalizing white supremacist logics in relationship to other black people. So the answer to that question would be like, in some cases, yes. I do think black feminists or black women or black men or black progressives, etc., can be termed or compared next to white supremacist liberals.
Okay. Person who dialed in, last four digits, 8453. 8453. Did you have a question for Dr. Curry?
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
How you doing? I was listening to the show. I'm from Detroit, Michigan, and we're experiencing a lot of racial things as well. I wanted to know, how does the studies of black men help us you know, help the people now that are in Detroit that are the low hanging fruit, getting frisked and going to jail and being killed at alarming rates. And you don't hear about people from Detroit that are getting shot down, unarmed right. men, and stuff like that.
Well, I think there's two things, right? I mean, outside of people that are just writing about it, just to write about it, I think there's a way in which, you know, academic professors in many ways inform what's going on in the legal profession, consulting, people who are ground roots activists, people who are sociologists, et cetera. The thing that we have to think about here is how we coordinate black intellectuals and black academics to the ground level. And what I'm saying is that because we don't have any perception like either the water crisis or stop and frisk or the genocide of black men at the hands of cops, and nobody's really attending to that, we don't have policy recommendations coming from black political scientists or black lawyers about how we organize on the ground around it. So what we need are really, in this case, black lawyers who are going to be in charge and organizing, you know, the NAACP or whatever other activist groups against this type of issue. The other thing is we need people to speak out about it. We have all kind of people that speak out about whatever kind of ridiculous thing they have, you know, on MSNBC or writing a Salon or the Huffington Post, but nobody's writing these types of, you know, pieces based on research, not based on, well, I feel bad that Mike Brown died. But look, Mike Brown is just another example, because there's a Mike Brown in Florida, there's a Michael Brown in Detroit, there's a Michael Brown in Louisiana. We're not getting that kind of coordination. And one of the things that I try to do, you know, both on my Twitter page, my Facebook page, and in my research, and when I go out and give conferences, is I'm trying to educate people about what's actually happening, that we can't just turn our backs on them because they're black men. You know, in my work, I call this anti-black chauvinism. So what I'm trying to suggest to people is that as a black community, we've internalized some of these kind of logics where we can say, we accept black men dying, we know they're at risk, so we're just going to do things like get them mentors or keep them off the street. Okay. That's not just the issue. The issue is that if they're on the street or they're in school, that people are still trying to kill them. And that's something that we haven't really attended to in the literature, and we have no explanations for. So it's a coordination effect. It's not just like one academic's going to come to Detroit and save the day, but it's that we need to have conversations about the problem so that we can mobilize people to do certain things.
What do I do as a black man? I'm not an intellectual. I'm not a university scholar, you know. What do we do? Do we just sit around and wait for you guys?
No. Don't ever wait for academics, no.
Right.
No, I would never say that, man, no. Look, the reality of the situation is that if you're in your neighborhood and this is happening, right, then there needs to be some, I know there's a preacher there or there's somebody that's organizing some of the ground roots protests around, you know, the water shortage. This needs to be brought up in a local community forum, and that needs to try to get some kind of national attention, some kind of national play about how they're killing these black men on the ground, and try to get some kind of civil rights activists or some attention there. In terms of what, you know, academics could do, they can, you know, assist in terms of their writing, but academics are not an activist class. So don't wait for academics, especially black academics, to do anything. If they want to help, fine, but don't wait for them to try to come in and try to save the day. I mean, that's why we have black lawyers or black politicians. You have senators, you have reps, you have those types of people to do that. You know, that becomes an option. You know, worst case scenario, then you're talking about grassroots, you know, self-defense. You know, but I don't advocate those things lightly. But I mean, that's the reality. If you're in that type of world and you're saying, what do we do right now? And those are going to be your options.
All right. Okay. Thanks a lot, brother.
No, man, I appreciate it.
The person that called in, last four digits, 5497. 5497. Did you have a question for Dr. Curry?
Yes. I was liking a lot of what you're saying. And the main thing of my issue with it all was, I was going to ask, does the brother think that it's more or less, you know, as far as those who academia and the ones who use the bourgeoisie element of our communities, because we've been so long in upholding the system of white supremacy, that is really the core base of why we can't get ahead, because we can't galvanize, because we have too many of those who are coming out in these marches and everything and making names for themselves and a better life for them and their immediate families and so on. And this is a big reason and problem why we can't get ahead as a people, because we have the masses out here who, certain people who came in the past and presented that and said that it was a mass problem. But we have others who step in the line, and they really are agents for white supremacy. And it is people getting paid off.
Absolutely.
And those things. So, I mean, what can we do unless we are in the grassroots movement, you know, and involved in those, to be able to galvanize our people and let them know and to be able to weed out these parts or these thorns that's in our community, which is our own help in the system of white supremacy.
Right. Well, look, I can't disagree with you, right? I mean, you know, like I said, the piece that I was writing today is just about that, how these black academics internalize the neoliberal system. So, and you know, I mean, think about it, man. Most of these black academics are not interested in being on black talk radio. They're not interested in speaking about black people, right? To black people, I am, right? I mean, because these cats, they want to be on NBC and whatever else, you know, white show they got of the day, because that's what gives recognition and visibility. And then they want to go that from that to, you know, Ferguson. My issue is simple, that we can't believe that everybody that has a PhD knows what the hell they're talking about. It's just that simple. If you don't come from the neighborhood, if you don't come from the state, then you don't know the issues that affects that community. And they could be like the issues you experience, but they're not going to be the same issues. So unless you're talking about people that are in that neighborhood that have already organized, that come to you to ask for help, or they come, you know, asking for something specific that you're good at, then there's no reason for black academics to believe that they control every proletariat or revolutionary movement that happens in this country around the death of black people. And what you have is them believing, as an academic class, they somehow control the fate and the interpretation of black death. That's a very dangerous thing to happen, where people, where mothers and fathers are trying to put what they have no control over, but where these academics believe they have legitimate claim to the interpretation of these events over people's lives, and that's just not the case. They're not reflective enough. Most people do this stuff because they want attention for what they say and do, not because they believe that their research is transformative. And that's the sad reality of the black academic class. What I'm trying to say is that we have to check that. As black people, we have to check that. We have to make sure that what they're saying and what they present on television or what they present about us is something that we accept. So if we disagree with Melissa Harris Perry, I mean, I know I disagree with her about the checklist for Trayvon Martin. I was pissed off about it because I'm saying this brother's dead. How are you creating a checklist for how white people should talk about Trayvon Martin? That seems like a complete waste of time, right? So when I had my show on SiriusXM, that's what I was criticizing. I was saying, look, this is not what we need to focus on. It's a problem to believe that we have to explain to white people how we need to talk about this in the first place. This is not the time for that, right? So we need to make sure that we're doing things as a black community and within the communities in these local states that are going to have longevity in our neighborhoods. It's going to happen at a neighborhood level. It's not going to be this grand thing that academics just speak a paper in existence and somehow things change, you know. So I agree with you. I think it's this inculcation of liberal, neoliberal, white supremacist ideas where black people or the black academic class kind of exploit the suffering of black people in our communities to get ahead. And it's unfortunate, but that's one of the things that happened with, you know, bourgeois black people from day one. They benefit from a structure and they keep benefiting from it.
That's right. I appreciate you, brother. Keep up the good work.
Appreciate it, sir. Thank you.
Right on. Another person wrote in. She said that black males are being killed in different ways, meaning being shot. And you were talking about there's such a disparity between the number of police shootings of black males in comparison to the number of black females that are shot by police. She said that black females are killed in different ways than black males, but are still being killed. Why should that not be brought out? And why should black females be attacked or criticized for saying that we feel that our issues are not being given the same amount of attention or not talked about or not recognized, that we are also victims of white supremacy racism?
I think I took great care to say that I don't think you should be demonized. I just said that I don't think that it's a zero-sum game. So if we're serious about talking about the deaths of black women, then I would ask, well, then why aren't we challenging black feminism or black female scholars to write about those issues like heart disease and poverty and malnutrition and obesity and residential segregation and the feminization of poverty where black men are being killed or they're taken to jail and it leaves the brunt of child care as well as health care on a black female who doesn't have full-time employment but is working two or three part-time jobs so they have no insurance, right? These are the things that majority affect black women in our most, you know, economically marginalized communities. Those then should be the subjects of study. I have absolutely no argument against that. In fact, what I'm trying to say is that that's what should be studied, right? I'm not saying that we shouldn't attend to black women being shot by police. We should. But if we have such a disparity between it, and the things that affect black women are things like poverty, heart disease, obesity, and access to, you know, good food or clean water, as they're doing with Detroit, then why does that not become the focus of study? It's not a one-size-fit-all. My wife calls it a Me Too syndrome. She's like, you know, if a black man gets killed, then the black feminist has to say Me Too, right? If a black man or black men are subject to stop and frisk, then suddenly now we have this march on catcalling, right? She's like, this is a Me Too thing. And she's a sociologist, so she's like, here's the issues that affect black women. Here's what we should be talking about. For me, it's just that simple. I'm not going to tell anybody they shouldn't talk about any black people. That's not what I'm about doing. But what I'm saying is that if we're going to make an argument that, you know, Trayvon Martin gets press and Renisha McBride did get more press, but you have 200 other black men who we don't even know their names about, then why are we arguing that black men get more press? Because basically you're just saying Trayvon got more press than Renisha. It doesn't mean that black people, black men as a class, get more press, because there's people we don't even know about, and we know about Renisha, and we actually got a conviction. I'm saying attend to the actual problems in our community. It's not about gender. If we feel that way, then challenge people to write about black women. I certainly write about black women, but ask yourself why these black feminists who keep talking about domestic abuse and intersectionality haven't written one article on black women being killed by police. That would be a good question to ask for me if we're actually interested in this kind of scholarship.
Right on.
Ask, why is it hashtags, right? Why doesn't it become a research program if that's what we're really talking about?
Have the quote unquote, and I'm not even implying that you have said this, but if such individuals exist, good white people that are not racist, or white people that are trying sincerely to solve this problem, if you have observed such individuals, how have they responded over the past couple of weeks with what happens in Ferguson, Mr. Crawford, Mr. Garner? Have you seen any white people who've had a correct, sincere response to all of this?
I mean, I've seen white people have correct responses. I don't know how sincere it is. I mean, you know, I've met white people who seem to get it, but Mike Brown being shot, Trayvon Martin being shot, you know, Renisha McBride, Ayanna Stanley. I mean, I was really upset about Ayanna Stanley because I have two little girls, right? You know, they don't feel that the same way. So while their politeness and their sympathy may be appreciated, it's inconsequential to the realities that face black people. Because that one white person isn't going to change the structures and the deaths that black people have to deal with. And this is what really pissed me off. When Ayanna Stanley got killed, there wasn't anybody talking about that baby. There wasn't one person. I got on SiriusXM and I waited. I was like, there's not one person talking about this baby, not one blog dedicated to this baby. And I was mad because I was like, that could have been my daughter. They came in searching for a father, ended up killing the baby, right? That's what I'm saying. This is why I'm saying that the deaths of black men can't be looked at just as their corpses, but in terms of how it affects the women and children in our lives. This is not a damn identity politic. This is about how the genocidal rage that they feel against black men is killing the black community. And people act like they just can't hear that, right? They don't criminalize a whole block because they just want to kill the black girl child. They do it because they want to kill the black man, and that baby ends up dying because of it. They don't starve the black community simply because they hate black women. They starve the black community because they don't want it to reproduce and produce more black men. So you demonize black women because they have black male babies. You sterilize them so they don't produce that black male baby. And you exploit their labor for work, or you make them suffer through poverty, but they become your bottom wage earner. Right? That's the problem, that people don't want to connect dots, and we keep having damn arguments about black women and black men and black gay men and black lesbians and black children. What difference does that make if all of them have the same life chances? You're arguing about attention. You're arguing about who gets the spotlight, but it doesn't matter because when the lights go off, they all die. And they're killed through different ways. Poverty, obesity, heart disease versus just shooting them in the head, or incarceration. Right? That's what I'm saying. That's the difference between playing identity politics and understanding actual murder. Understanding how white supremacy works to keep a whole people in a situation of colonization and depravity. Right? But that's what I'm saying. We can't wrap our minds around that kind of reality.
She's still at Lashes. Did you have a question for Dr. Curry? Your line should be open.
Hi, yes. Good evening. I was just listening to your guest just a few minutes ago, and it made me think about basically the academia of people who are classified as black do all these researches on the population, which is considered the working poor black group, just to get funding from a particular institution to get the MFA or PhD, yet with that same information that they're gathering on the group of the working poor population that are classified as black, no one's doing anything with this intel that they're gathering in order to really produce anything within those giving particular communities or segment groups. So, since you mentioned the guest, that is, since you mentioned that the academia, those who are classified as black, are basically working for and have the aspiring energy and will to be like the white supremacist, like them doing these research is just basically useless and futile.
Yeah, I mean, if it doesn't connect to black people, absolutely. And that's why I try to do the work that I do. You know, I don't really do blogs, but I do talk radio. I try to comment on things based on what I actually know and how it could help black people. My whole research program is specifically on the issues in black communities. That's what I do. That's what I'm saying. Like, it's not like as a black academic I'm a miracle worker, but I try to talk about things and I try to teach my students concrete ways that they can engage the community. So when we have black teachers or we have people that's coming from education or people from sociology, I'm like, look, here's how you as a hands-on person can change this situation. Right? Here's how this theory matters to how you teach this. Here's this, how, because that's what's going to formulate a culture of people that come out that are going to be able to do things. Because, there's one guy, brilliant guy, who's in my undergraduate classes, and he's being a doctor. And after he took my classes and I told him about, the different things that black men are exposed to versus black women, he's like, well, look, I'm going to work in low-income communities in black neighborhoods, black and brown neighborhoods, right? That's something that helps us, right? Because we could teach people about the problems, increase their awareness, and then they could take their passion to be a doctor and go out and help our communities. But if you're a professor that teaches them all this theory, and they have no connection whatsoever, they can't feel that community, they just want to make money, then what are we producing, right? And that, for me, that's always the question. It doesn't mean it's going to work and it's going to be 100% successful, but we need people that are smarter than us that are at the ground doing something. And that's just the way I look at it. I just don't think most academics write with that intent in mind.
Yeah, because it also makes me think that the classified black academia is pretty much looking at the poor working class groups and as a pool of people to exploit, which is what
Absolutely.
The system already does in the first place. Yet,
Absolutely.
For some reason, these black academia folks think that they are immune because they are working in the ivory tower, yet at the same time, currently, the ivory tower is kicking them out one by one, denying them tenure,
it's not
exactly. XYZ in the third. So
that's one of my arguments that I work on, right? Because, and here's the funny part about it, right? And this is why I don't really get along with black feminists, is because I say that when you talk to black women about their issues, right? Like, if you go to your neighborhood, like, if I go talk to my mom or my aunts, we're from Louisiana, right? Small, poor town in Louisiana. And I say, well, look, what's going on? What's affecting you? You see things like poverty, jobs, healthcare, right? These are the things that are affecting black women, right? And that doesn't mean that there's not other types of oppressions, right? Like, sexism, et cetera. But this is what they're saying, look, this person doesn't have this, this, and that. And then when I come back to the university, I say, well, look, Here's something that, I found research on. Here it coordinates what I've talked to in this small sample. My wife does research on this. Here's how I think we should reformulate the notion of gender in relationship to racism and residential segregation. People are like, well, that's not feminist. So you see what I'm saying? So it doesn't matter that I've gone somewhere, listened to people, then I've looked at their conversation next to research and found other people that say this is a problem too, then coordinated that with a sociologist who says, yeah, this makes sense in terms of this, this, and that, and then I present it as a philosopher saying, here's why gender doesn't hold up and what we need to change. None of that matters. It doesn't meet the ideology provocation, right? So, I don't really waste my time talking to those people anymore. It's because I just don't find them genuinely interested in what's happening in black communities. Right. Well, what they have is a story about black men always being oppressors. Right. And I think black men are human, so I certainly think there have been times where black men have been oppressive. I think there are times where black men beat women just because they do, because they want to feel powerful. But I don't think that's all the time. And I don't think that that's the majority of the times, because when I look at the research, it tells me something different. And I don't think that black women are always innocent. I think that black women do abuse black boys, and that creates certain types of stigmas and psychological problems so that they have misogynistic tendencies because they were abused by a black woman or a woman in their community. Or same thing with a man, right? I look at things as if things cause black people to have problems. I don't believe black people are fundamentally pathological. And what the black academic generally does is view the black working class and the black poor as a pathological group that they can study. And I'm just not willing to do that.
Right, because once you say for yourself, for example, if you decide to take the approach of, okay, if I'm going to do for one, meaning study and look at the issues of black males, I must do for the other, which right. is also, I must do the same attentive approach to the black mm-hmm. females, because growing up, my great-grandmother always told me, like, even if it was like our birthday, because I have a brother, and mm-hmm. we're 5 years apart, so say if it was my birthday, yes, we're celebrating my birthday, but she always had a little something for my brother. And right. vice versa, if it was my brother's birthday, we'll make a big deal for him, but she has a little something for me.
Right.
Her motto was, if you're going to do for one, you got to do for the other.
Exactly.
That has always been her motto. That was my great-grandmother here. And,
yeah, and
I just don't understand why, well, I do understand why we haven't taken that approach, but that approach of doing for one and for the other should be cohesive and in operation in our thought, body, speech, and action on a continuum basis.
Exactly. And that's why I was trying to really push that my argument isn't that we don't need to attend to black women, but we need to talk about how the deaths of black men affect black women and black families and black children. So I get to still talk about all the issues of poverty and underemployment and, you know, black female suffering, but I do it through the relationship with the larger political issue of anti-black death. And my wife studies residential segregation and obesity in black women. So we constantly have conversations, and she's constantly talking to me about how my work in anti-black death or anti-blackness affects, you know, residential segregation, and it mixes with critical race theory, and how that affects obesity and access to food and even nutrition for what black women cook or poor black women cook for their children. So it's not a situation where I come to it with a zero-sum logic. Unfortunately, I think that's the way that most academics do, because we don't see our ideas as having to be true. We just see them as having to be popular. And what I'm trying to get is truth. I'm trying to make sure that my theories are testable, that we can see them operating in the world. And, you know, I mean, sometimes that's hit or miss. You know, I have to constantly think about, revise, and read more, you know.
So if that's the case, it seems to be more about what's popular. It sounds like academia, at some point in time, has turned into another vehicle of public relations, public propaganda. Not actually doing, say, a scientific approach of, okay, this is my theory, this is my lab, where I'm going to experiment on my theory and see what actually produced from XYZ. You understand what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, philosophers don't, humanist scientists don't really do that, but I think that's why we think we need to be interdisciplinary, so we can't just keep making up stuff and acting like we don't have to test it. You know, and I think the social sciences are much better at that. But, yeah, you're right, though. I mean, it becomes a big PR fest. Everybody has to be intersectional. Everybody has to dismiss the Civil Rights Movement or the Black Panther movement being said. I mean, there's, like, these tropes that everybody has to believe in, right? You have to believe that black women are the most oppressed, right, even though they get more degrees in X, Y, and Z. Like, there's just no nuance. These are just things you have to believe. And if you don't believe that, right, then suddenly you become a bad person, or you're misogynist, or you're sexist, or you're patriarchal, or X, Y, and Z, right? So, you know, and you just kind of accept that. You know, if you're going to do this type of work, you just accept that's how people are going to view it, you know. So, I mean, I have tenure, luckily, so it really just doesn't bother me at this point. I just choose to talk to certain people and not talk to certain people. What I care about is when, you know, I go on radio shows or when I write a piece and people email me and say, look, that made a lot of sense, here's what happened to me, and I started having those dialogues. That's what matters to me. Because that means that people can read my work, is accessible, and they're like, hey, I'm going to use this to teach this class, or a debater says, hey, I'm going to use this in a debate round to educate people about this issue. That's what matters to me. Because that means that black people are looking at that and it's changing the way they think, and then when you have relations, because I talk to pretty much everybody that emails me. So I'm like, you know, so that means then that they're actually employing and deploying that knowledge to serve the interests of black folk. The other stuff is just, you know, It's an academic circle jerk. People want to be loved by other people. And that's fine, because I understand that's how you advance in it. But that's not going to help black people. And the problem is that we have so many theories that fly around. What we don't do is have a conscious philosopher or theorist that's trying to marry that to what our social scientists and our psychologists and our lawyers are really doing. So that's what I try to do.
Thank you very much.
No, thank you. Thank you.
The person that dialed in, last four digits, 8278, 8278. Did you have a question for Dr. Curry?
Yes. Greeting, Gus. Greeting, Dr. Tommy Curry.
Hey, sir. How you doing?
One of my, I'm great. One of my favorite guests on the Cows. One of your, on your last appearance on the Cows, part two, or maybe part one, I don't, and this isn't verbatim, you mentioned, contrary to popular belief, admixtures were around before colonization. I was hoping you could give us an idea of that worldwide, specifically in this part of the world.
Oh, yeah. I think, if I remember correctly, I would have been citing Du Bois of the Negro, 1915, where he was talking about migration and racial admixture was a common part. So in that part of the book I was talking about, all he's talking about is that before there were nation-state boundaries, people moved freely. There was a freedom of movement. So you expected racial and cultural intermixing. Van Sertima writes about that, about Africans here, where he talks about how they mix with indigenous folk in North America and South America. But the idea was that before you had strict racial taxonomies where one race was pure and perfect and the other one was degraded and inferior, you didn't have this kind of phobia, or you certainly didn't have a Negro phobia, but you didn't have this kind of phobia that if races or ethnicities or cultures mixed, that was somehow going to destroy or, you know, degrade the other race, because there was no hierarchy. They represented their own culture. So I think what Du Bois was getting at was that white supremacy really started this whole notion that you can have racial degradation if you marry or reproduce with an allegedly inferior race.
Yeah, okay. You said something that just really resonated with me as far as Africans coming over here. You know, there's a lot of evidence out there. I mean, you basically got two stories. I mean, you know, Du Bois aside, you got these white writers, authors overseas, and in some cases here, talking about how the people here were actually melanated people. And, you know, a lot of this stuff, that story has been thrown around pretty much worldwide in order to, I mean, you know, you got Rwanda, you got the Tutsis and the Hutu. I don't know if I'm saying that right. But, you know, they're basically, you know, Germans gave them a story and Europeans here gave us a story. And,
right.
You know, removed from the land, replace them with Sicilians, replace them with Vietnams, from, you know, Asians, replace them with admixtures, and you tell them they're the natives.
Right.
You know, how important, and I think it's very important that we know this. I mean, sometimes it's at this point it's a little scary. You know, you have all these people waking up to the fact that, you know, we were here the whole time. You know, that's absurd,
right.
and just, you know, just totally against the story. But that's the other story. And there's a lot of evidence to that other story with actual things backing it up that the Native Americans here today, so-called Native Americans, that they don't even, like, make anymore.
Right.
Like mounds and artifacts.
That's really what Frazier was talking about when he saw all these other intellectuals, that they don't really care about history, man. They don't care about what's lost by colonization. Right, I mean, when Van Sertima wrote "They Come Before Columbus," what he's trying to show is that look, there's a history that existed before colonization. There's a history that comes before the idea of a white man discovering the world. All right, and unless we actually understand, and this is the same point that Woodson made, unless we actually understand our history before enslavement, right, then we're going to simply buy into the stories and narratives that we get from enslavement. Right, and that's what Frazier means when he says that the people who are unconscious of their racial position are perhaps the greatest victims of it, because you're in a position, you don't understand that you've been brainwashed, and you keep advancing things as if that's the theory to advance or that's the history to advance, right? But the only difference, other people question it, you just accept it. You know, that's the problem that he says with the, you know, black academic class. So I think that a lot of people don't really get into, you know, Vincertimer or Chancellor Williams or Diop because, you know, they're classified as Afrocentrist. And when you classify somebody as an Afrocentrist in the academy, that means that you shouldn't read them. And if you do or ever mention their work, you'll be considered a bad black person, especially in philosophy, unless you're in black studies, you know. In the field that I deal with, they're like, oh, well, that's just, you know, that's just made up stuff, right? Because that's the way they view it. But the reality of the situation is that some of our greatest intellectual and historical thinkers have come from that vein. So you think about John Edward Bruce, author of Schomburg, who taught John Henry Clark, who taught, you know, all these other historians. You know, those are really the people that are foundationally committed to finding out the truth about black people. You know, a lot of other people are just kind of playing, you know.
Hmm. Henry Clark. okay.
He's a bad man.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know if we're thinking the same definition of bad. I just, you know, I think that really messes with us. I mean, you know, just, you know, we come from Africa, and you know, there's all their stuff here still, you know, and I just the point I'm trying to make is, I think it's the story that's happening now. Mm-hmm. Bad mixtures. You got Mexico's taking over. Mexicans take it. I was sleepy. I seen Dr. Curry on the page, Black Talk Radio Network. I said, oh, I got a call. So
I appreciate it.
You know, it's like shutdown time. I'm just, but I had to call. I had to ask you. I'm sorry. You got Mexicans coming over here, across the border, occupying America. You got the Muslims in Europe. And, you know, it just, you know, it seems like, you know, they got their stories like, oh, yeah, this was our land before. And, you know, I just,
that's what I'm saying. But we have to be careful not to mix the political situation of the day with how we read history back. Right? Mexicans were invented the same way that Mexico was, right? You know, I mean, what we're dealing with now is the products of how a colonial history has told us the world is, right? And we see ourselves as being fundamentally different than people from Latin America and South America. And the reason that we do is because those people in many ways don't see themselves as having any African heritage, especially when they come to North America, right? So that's what I'm saying. That's all a product of the same kind of white supremacy. The question is, how invested are we to act and understand the world differently? And most people don't want to go through that, because if I'm competing with a job for somebody who's Latino or Latina, right, and I'm black, then I'm going to employ the same kind of rationalizations that most people see, you know, want us to employ anyway, that we don't have solidarity, but we're actually competing with each other for the same jobs, while we're actually trying to compete for a job to work in a white person's house. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, and those terms are very important. Like African, when I call you African, what do you mean? Like, do you mean from Africa? Like, we were actually just brought over here on like sardine cans, and you know, just spread around the land. Like, what do you? And I'm not saying that didn't happen. I'm not trying to dismiss African translated slave trade. That actually did happen. I mean, not to that degree though. It weren't like you know, 12 numbers always changing. 6 million, 12 million.
Right.
It's a substantially smaller number. Okay. That were brought over here and all that stuff. I mean, I'm saying is, okay, what do you mean when you say African?
When I say African, I'm usually talking about continental African. When I describe black Americans or other people in the diaspora, I usually say African descended people.
Right.
So
from Africa.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. You know, I think that's just really just confused the heck out of us. You know,
this is what I'm saying. It's like, you know, when we talk about categories of thought, right?
Right.
You know, think about this. You have white people in America that largely come from all over, Irish, Scandinavian, all kind of Eastern European people. And no matter what they do, they still trace their civilization to Britain and then to Greece. So when you study philosophy, right, all these white people, because our field is mostly white, articulate their understanding of knowledge from Greece, from Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, right? You know, all the way through, right? And you read that, then you get to German idealism, et cetera, et cetera. And none of these white people in America have any clue, much less connection to those actual civilizations. But see, that's the explanation, that's the mythology they give themselves, so they believe that they're a great people, that they've come from ancient Greece, which was a great imperial state, with Alexander the Great and Aristotle. He conquered the world, and then they got to Britain with the Pax Britannica, and then they rejected Britain, and they came to America, and they created the greatest nation in the world. And that's their historical myth, right? And what black people do is we come back and we're like, oh, well, we're not African, we're not Caribbean, we're not X, Y, and Z, we're just black and we're American. So we we don't allow ourselves to invest in any great civilizational narrative, right?
Right.
And while it's mythology, so part of it's going to be not true, right? I accept that. But the other part of it is that people create mythologies because they want to perpetuate certain visions in their people. So it's just like when you're little, your mom or your dad tells you stories about a great black person because they want you to emulate the greatness of the character they're telling you about. Most of us talk about Martin Luther King because we're like, he fought for the best, the greatest of his people, right? And because of that, he was killed, but he knew that, you know, through his belief in God and faith X, Y, and Z, that things would change. And most of us are Christians, so that fits very well with how we want to raise our children. It's the same thing with that. Now, it's not completely true. Right? Martin Luther King didn't like white people. He didn't like white supremacy. Most of the stuff in his last book focused on economics, not God. Right? But that's not the story we want, because we don't want people, our children, going up talking about Vietnam and challenging the state. And, you know, that's not what we want, because that's very dangerous for them. You see what I'm saying? So we create mythologies based on how we want to train people, specifically our children, into the next thing or into the aspect that we want them to see, that we want to see in them as adults. That's all that white supremacy's done there. So then my question becomes, well, then why do we not do the same thing with black people? Because Du Bois did it. That's why he created the Brownie books. But generally speaking, that's not what we try to cultivate in our children.
Right, and I'm going to add to that.
Caller, hang tight, because we had other people that dialed in that had questions I want to make sure we can try and get everybody in. But I do appreciate that. The caller is 6492, 6492. Did you have a question for Dr. Curry? Your line should be open. Last four digits, caller at 6492. Did you have a question for Dr. Curry?
Guess we lost him.
Not sure what's happened to him. Oh, okay. Yes.
Can you hear me? I'm sorry.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes.
Okay. Sorry about that. I had myself on mute. I find what you're talking about fascinating, especially, you know, when you discuss, you know, all the work you've done. And I know Jess has done a lot of work, and, you know, Dr. Welsing, Mr. Fuller, Dr. Anderson, and I think you even hinted at this, that everything is disconnected. And so I am wondering, because I think we need a solution pretty quickly, because it doesn't seem to me that the white supremacists are going to back down. They're actually, in my opinion, getting much, much worse, much bolder. And so I think that it's time that we get a, you know, definitive action plan, whatever it is. And I don't know where we're going to get funding, you know, because I kind of doubt that they're going to help us. And I know that I'm certain that they will do everything they can to hinder us in every possible way. A lot of the things that you've talked about, the things that we saw in Ferguson, that, you know, they were sending provocateurs in there to cause trouble.
Right.
So do you have thoughts? Have you tried to pull together like a position paper or a plan or anything?
Well, the work I'm doing now in my book is actually about armed self-defense. Right, and how we justify armed self-defense like Robert F. Williams. I think I mentioned this last time, you know, armed self-defense against these types of racist murders. But again, like I said, I don't say that to be provocative, because I know that when you say something like that to black people, then it's kind of, you know, it's like, oh, well, he's saying that we should arm ourselves and kill white people. And that's not really what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to say is that if we know that we don't have a governmental response where people who even peacefully protest are going to be shot or killed, then we need to figure out what we're going to do with that situation. And in the best case scenario, or the case that's historically worked, has been that black people have armed themselves. Now, do I know that's going to work again against a militarized state? Absolutely not. But then we have to ask ourselves, what are we losing by trying to encounter it, the militarized state, peacefully, and our young black men and boys are being slaughtered in the streets? So I think that, you know, if there's an action plan that's going to be called upon, you know, I think we need to have a national conference about it. We need to put out a position paper on it. As far as my own ideas, that's just kind of where I'm at right now, because I see so many people dying, so many people being abused, so many black mothers crying, that I can't keep saying that we should, you know, just keep protesting in the streets. And I think that what we see, especially in Ferguson, is, you know, and this is actually a really important point. You know, see, I think that the the academics, you know, like to talk themselves into a corner. But imagine what would happen if we saw all those people that were out in Ferguson, they were all black women. So the tear gas, the shooting, the strangulations, the choking, the arrest, they were all our black women. And think about how the nation would react to something like that. Think about how we would react to something like that, right? It wouldn't happen, right? Because we know that's not how our communities are organized, right? So when we have these ideas about solutions, what we need to really talk about is how we both protect the people in our community. That means that our wives, our mothers, our children, and how we politically activate ourselves so that we're not just walking into a situation where they have rationalization to kill everybody. Because we see what they do to our women. They beat them up. They incarcerate them. They molest them, right? We see what they do to our men. They kill them. They give them no dignity and leave their bodies out on the streets. If that's the situation that we're confronting, then we can't pretend that us just putting more black bodies in the streets are not going to be subject to more abuse. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and that's, you see, and that's what I'm saying. That's what bothers me, is that, you know, I'm fine with us saying that we could riot. I'm fine with us saying that we could justify looting because, I mean, you know, I'm not saying I personally advocate it, but I'm saying if that's how the argument's going to go, that's fine. But what do you do when the police roll up and start shooting those bodies? Like, that's the thing that upsets me. Like, what? Nobody gets to the next step. Like, what happens if the police roll up? Like, I've seen all these celebrities that have gone to Ferguson, and I'm saying, so what if these police come up because, you know, they're pointing guns at you already? Do you just think you're that different that they won't shoot you? Like, what if they say, I mean, what if they raid the like they did the Dream Defenders and raid the church? What if they just raid everything and these academics, they just start killing people? Right? And they say they were, and they spin a story. Like, what, I'm always wondering, because I see these people talking all this noise on Twitter, you know, and there was actually a story, that they broke out that said that the cops said, look, you know, if you move, I'm gonna kill you. And these academics were down there. And people were like, well, this is the scariest I've been. But I'm like, but black men go through this every day. Like, it was a woman talking, but I was like, I've had two guns. I had a pea coat on the chessboard on my back in Chicago. Two guns, dude had a gun, cop put a gun right in my window, made me get out, patted me down, the guy was locked on me. I could have died then, right? And I had to stay calm, right? Despite the fact thinking that I could literally die right now. Right? Like, what are we doing to train people to be able to work under those kind of stresses? Because that doesn't mean you go from your classroom to Ferguson and say, oh, I'm training, I'm ready. Because in the civil rights movement, they had to train people. They had to desensitize them to that kind of stress. You see what I'm saying? You see what I'm saying? But we're not doing any of that. We just telling people, go show up, you know, tweet, observe, it makes no sense to me. It makes absolutely no sense to me. That's what I'm saying. We're not really prepared to deal with death. So that's why I'm saying that if we come up with a program, it's going to have to involve some form of self-defense. And if it doesn't involve that, then we have to be ready to say that we're going to sacrifice people's lives to try to get justice in this country, which was what we did in the 60s and 70s.
Right, absolutely, and I kind of saw that you know, it's almost like we were sending sheep to slaughter, you know,
exactly.
While going down there, because actually, you know, I'm on the web quite a bit, and I have a lot of right wing followers, and I have no idea why, but you know, they've been tweeting about race war, and they were going berserk. They thought they were finally ready for their little race war, and it's like, look, you know. We have issues, but we're not quite that stupid. We know that there's 300 million of you guys with guns, so.
Right, but that's what they're training for, right? Look at when Zimmerman got killed. You had white militias saying that they're coming to protect George Zimmerman.
Yes.
See, that's what I'm saying. That's what I mean when I say we don't have a real grasp on the situation. Right?
No, we
have white populations that all they do is fight about gun rights and want to be able to carry their gun. I had a student do his dissertation. Ty Couch did a dissertation on the kind of psychology behind why they want to carry their guns. He did qualitative interviews with like two or three different chapters of, you know, people for the conservative gun movement, and it found that across the board, they believe they were readying themselves to fight against black men. So you have a whole movement in this country about guns rights that's really code for fighting against black men. And then you're surprised that all these black men are dying. Because there's a culture that is telling you they're the danger. So then black people get up and say, well, we're going to go march on X, Y, and Z, not even thinking that you're dealing with rational white people. Like, this is not an issue where white people are going to say, wow, you know, they really gave their lives, now we're going to support them. We see the exact opposite.
then black people go and get shot, and white people say, let's fund the person that shot them. So my question is, are you banking on white people's moral consciousness, or are you just walking into a situation because you just want your 10 minutes on TV? Because I don't understand. If white people aren't going to morally change, then what are we doing?
Mm-hmm. No, because they're there. They used to see, I don't know if you've been following, like, a lot of the comments on the articles, and, you know, they how much money they raised for the cops. They killed the child.
Well, absolutely.
You know, what got me upset is when I saw that police chief give that press conference filled with nonsense. There was no way that that child would have been dead if what he said was true.
Exactly.
No way. No way, because he wouldn't have. He would still have had the gun, right?
Right.
So why? Right, but why there's an argument over what happened? They're still tweeting at me right now. I just had to take a break from them, but that's why we need a plan. We need to look at reality, not what we think it should be, not what we've been taught it should be, but what it really is. These people care nothing for us and would not hesitate to take any of us out of here in a heartbeat. Because they believe we're the cause of all their problems.
Exactly.
Even the so-called Christian ones. And those are the worst ones on, Internet.
Well, yeah, see, but again, this is what I'm saying, that if we're going to develop a plan of action, it has to be based on the fact that we're dealing with a very real problem and a real, very real homicidal rage that affects, that kills black men and affects the whole community. So until we get our heads around that, then I don't think that we're going to have any effective thing. Because, again, like I said, we have people making arguments about why they're not going to march for dead black men simply because they didn't get their political will of the day.
Right, right.
You're not going to build solidarity around that. Yeah, I mean, it's silly.
Yeah,
honestly, like, you got to think about how silly this is. Well, they don't support domestic abuse. They don't think we should be part of My Brother's Keeper. That means they disagree with you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, we can disagree about policies, right? I can say I think that because black women graduate, from college at a higher rate, that maybe this isn't the first thing we should focus on. Not saying it's not important, but maybe it's not. Maybe I just disagree with you about that issue. But because I disagree with you about this issue, despite how strongly you feel about it, this person gets shot in broad daylight or gets choked to death in broad daylight, we're not going to organize around that because I disagree with you about something completely different. You see what I'm saying? We can't agree on the value of black life because I disagree with you politically.
Right.
They don't do that.
They get lockstep. They don't care what a low life this cop was. They don't care what a low life George Zimmerman was. There was issues about whether he was really white or not. Didn't care. They stepped right in line.
Exactly. And that's the difference. He could have been an immigrant for all they care. Right?
Right.
He killed a black boy. They supported George Zimmerman. Right, and that's what I'm saying. And look at the people, and this is what I always tell people, look at the people who get to benefit from black males' deaths. So George Zimmerman got off. His lawyer is now constantly commenting on CNN. So his lawyer became famous, right? Think of all the people who've gotten to do talks in the academy based on Trayvon Martin, right? Mm-hmm. You see, this is what I mean. Like, black people get to profit.
Still on TV.
Exactly.
He made a lot of people rich.
Exactly. And that's what I'm saying. So look who gets to benefit off of the symbolic worth of a black man dying. And then we come back and say, oh, but we need to pay more attention to X, Y, and Z. Fine, pay attention to it. But ask yourselves, that black man's dead. And black men aren't in the academy. And they don't get jobs. And they don't graduate from high school. So who's left to talk about black men? It's not more black men. The people who get the people who get more awards for their research on dealing with the Black Panthers and the black men of the 60s are white people. Some of which are white feminists. Because they're allowed to go in and study these people and study their histories and tell us all kind of fascinating stories about it. While every time black men try to study themselves, they say, you can't do that because you're sexist. So you have people that materially benefit from writing books, doing conferences, writing articles. One woman got an article, an award for an article, because she was showing that the Black Panthers were actually reading feminist literature. So, like, when these feminists would put out their newspapers or they do their talks, these Black Panthers were actually reading it, writing about it, listening to it, and then writing about it in their newspapers. So she's refuting the idea that Black Panthers didn't care anything about women's liberation. Something that was quite obvious to anybody who's ever sat down and read, Huey P. Newton or Cleaver or any of these other people, right? Because Cleaver actually has a book where he actually talks about women's liberation. It's just not published. So if you actually did research, you'll know this. But these white people get to study our own people and make money from them because we discourage black people from studying themselves. Unless, of course, it's feminist or it's performance theory or it's intersectionality, et cetera, right? So there's a lot of work to be done. So I don't, you know, I think that we're going to develop a plan that needs to be something concrete that really considers the kind of enemy that we're dealing with. Outside of that, I think it's going to be talking isolated to social media.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank the female caller for dialing in. Appreciate her feedback as well. The your student who did the dissertation on these white militia groups, I was greatly intrigued. We would love to have him on the program to hear more about
Fantastic. This
report. Is that possible? Like, maybe I can email you off the air and, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Cool.
I'm sure you would love to do it.
Outstanding. We'll see if we can make that happen. I didn't want to take up your whole evening, but I definitely wanted to ask, with everything that's been galvanized, I think Dr. Welsing and some other folks have said anytime that there's an event, even if it's a tragedy of a black person dying, if it forces a lot of white people and non-white people to speak publicly about racism, we should try and take advantage, make it as useful as possible. Do you think there are things that we can be doing to try to sustain all of this attention where you got people writing and talking about racism on a daily basis, violence against black people? Are there things we can do to try and maximize all of this attention? And what should those things that we should be doing? What are some of those things?
Man, that's a real tough question, man, because unfortunately what I see, and it's, you know, so I'm saying this is my opinion. What I see is a shift from week to week about the issues that affect black people. I think the problem with black academics now is that instead of having a sustained focus about racism, we talk about the hot topic because we want to get likes and retweets, not because we're really trying to sustain a movement of education. So I think that if we're going to sustain this, then we need to form conferences, put out papers, and coordinate with educators, people on the ground level that's educating our children or educating people in high school. We need to start talking to, you know, those types of things to make sure that this happens. I just don't have much faith in the academy because I don't think that you have academics that are really going to risk putting themselves or jeopardizing tenure to study black folk. I just don't see that. And I think that Dr. Welsing is correct insofar as she says that this could inspire people to do so. But, I mean, I just think that, you know, look how many black people we've lost, man. I mean, look how many black children. I mean, we're talking about children. Children, right? Jordan Davis was a child. Trayvon Martin was a child. Michael Brown was a child. We see black male children being killed. So if we can't galvanize, and this has been happening for the last 2 years, think about Kendrick Johnson, right? When you think about the brother that, you know, his parents exhumed his body and he didn't have any organs in it. You think about these kind of tragedies. What else has to be done for people to have a sustained conversation? This has been happening in the last 2 years. So I wish it was different. I just don't know what's going to be different about Michael Brown. You see what I'm saying?
Go ahead.
I'm sorry?
I was just going to ask, does that trying to sustain that effort or that effort period, does it have to come from the academy? I mean, could it be sustained at a grassroots?
Oh, absolutely not. No, I think it could be sustained on the ground, but then you're dealing with these kind of intimidation tactics that you're dealing with in Ferguson. See, that's what I'm saying. If it's sustained at the ground, right, then what's going to happen when the ground meets the road and has to deal with the police? What's going to happen when they have to deal with people like SWATs coming in and breaking them up or trying to infiltrate them? What's going to happen if they get classified as a terrorist organization or a hate group? You see what I'm saying? That's my fear, that if we keep talking in these types of, you know, ideals where we can say, well, this should happen, then what do we have to protect the people that we claim that we're backing? Because we don't live in a world anymore where people just have the freedom of speech that's not encroached upon by the government or by the police state. We don't live in a world where they won't send a drone over Ferguson, Missouri to find out what people are doing or tap their phone or take all their cell phone data. We live in the exact opposite world of that. This is what Huey Newton was talking about in War Against the Panthers in 1980. We live in a world where we're pretending that it's a civil society, but it's really undergirded by surveillance programs that are infiltrating and trying to find out everything they can about us, largely to exterminate us or de-radicalize any kind of move we have against them. So we're living in that world that we need to have a very different political theory about how we're going to engage white supremacy. And that's what I mean when I say that these things don't have any attention, because we don't know how to engage white supremacy and repression in a world of militarism and covert operations where people know everything about us, right?
Mm.
So you know, how do we sustain a movement in a world that's specifically designed to make sure that that movement can't happen?
Mm.
Now, that's the real question. But that's what I'm saying. But we're not getting a bunch of actual thinkers and grassroots people to figure that out. And when you're trying to have that conversation with people, like, I'll give you a great example. why is it that people who are doing philosophy want to argue about the definition of race instead of white supremacy?
Hmm.
You see what I'm saying? We're arguing about who counts as black. We're arguing about what race is. And that's what gets published. That's what gets rewarded. Not somebody that starts off with, like, look, I know what race is. It's the person that gets shot in the street. I know what race is. I'm serious. I know what race is because if it was a black woman, she's the one that's going to be sterilized if she's arrested. You see what I'm saying? Like, that's how I test race, right? It becomes very obvious because of the population affected by white supremacy. But we want to have these pretend conversations. So then when you have something like an argument like the stuff I write, it says, well, look, if this is the case, then we can't have any kind of moral disposition towards strategies that are going to bring freedom for us. In other words, if there's going to be a revolution, I can't worry about the value that I put on the oppressor's life because my job is to worry about the value of life to the people who are oppressed. But that's not very popular. But I was like, but this is how we do just war theory. This is how we understand the notion of the contract, right? The value of the person who's giving versus, you know, the exchange determines the value of the person as I perceive them, right? You don't value the people that's buying for you the same way that you value the people that you buy from that you depend on. That's the way that it works. But yet, anytime you put that into logics or the calculus of revolution, somehow now black people are morally bad. We don't want to recreate the structures of our oppressor. What the hell does that mean if we're oppressed? We don't have a problem reproducing the structures of our oppressor when we get a paycheck, right? It boggles my mind that we're not willing to have honest and earnest conversations about how we try to get out of this situation that we're in. And that's what I mean. Like, we don't even understand the kind of society that we live in right now. And Mike Brown, why he gives us a piece of that, why he gives us a taste of that, you know, I mean, you know as well as I do that as a black male, you live with that kind of fear, that anxiety, that every time you're stopped by a cop, you could die. That if somebody that you're walking down the street, someone could accuse you of something, no matter the fact that you did it or didn't do it, you're still going to be tried as if you're guilty. And it's that kind of anxiety that creates a completely different perspective on the world that most people just don't want to hear. And we can't build political theory or sustain movements because it's too pessimistic and because we know that certain people are going to come after us given our own lives. And what do you think is going to happen when we have a whole bunch of people that look like us? What is going to happen when we actually have people in the streets that are arming themselves? What happens when we have people that are standing up to the police? It's going to be much worse than Ferguson. Ferguson had cameras on them. What happens when those cameras aren't there? Ferguson had people tweeting about him. Ferguson had people that were there, didn't say Twitter. What are you going to do when the FBI shuts off, or Apple, or Facebook, or whoever shuts off all the cell phones because you're in police radius? You see what I'm saying? Like, we're not even prepared for those types of strategies, even though we read about them every day.
Hmm. Given the truth of what you just shared, I said about a week, almost 2 weeks ago now, I said with this case, Darren Wilson, it's no question. I think there were some white people, a significant portion, who did not accept George Zimmerman as white. This case is even stronger. Darren Wilson, as photos I've seen, undeniably, this is a white man.
And he's a cop.
Exactly. He's not a neighborhood watchman. He is an enforcement officer. I find it highly unlikely that he's even going to be indicted. I hear people talking about the trial. I just keep saying, I don't think it's going to get that far. I don't think he's going to be indicted. You've already seen white people raise all this money and everything else, and the spin that they're putting on it, that Michael Brown was some sort of criminal thug and what he had in his system and he robbed this store and all this. I just don't see that happening. And I've been thinking, okay, so if he is not indicted, and they've even been asking some black people, because they've even presented, I've heard this in the media, where they've said, hey, you know, most of the time, if an enforcement official kills someone, they don't get indicted. Most of the time, they don't get convicted. Amadou Diallo, nobody got convicted. Even, I think, Honest Stanley Jones, I don't think anybody got convicted for that. That's pretty typical. And they said, so what are you all going to do if Officer Wilson is not indicted? And they said, man, we'll be out in the streets. And just given what you said, Dr. Welsing, she was here this weekend. She said, I think, and particularly your student, his dissertation, she said, I think racists want black people to riot. Then they'll have an excuse to go out and do more black
killings. Exactly. Exactly. And that's my fear. That's what I'm saying. That's my fear. That's why I tell people, it's like, look, I'm not going to say that we shouldn't exercise our constitutional rights. I'm just going to say, if you understand that you're dealing with people who are fundamentally not respecting the Constitution, then you should have a plan B. You see what I'm saying? And that's what frustrates me about these conversations, is that we're not talking about a plan B. We're not actually engaged in the situation like we believe we could be Mike Brown. See, we're engaged in a situation like Mike Brown was a victim of somebody's bad decision. Not that the system is set up to make sure that there's going to be more Mike Browns. And that's why when I see all these academics going down there, they're saying, oh, we're showing solidarity. I was like, no, I know what you're showing. You're showing your desirability to be there and to be noticed for being there because you're not an activist. You don't know anything. You can't protect yourself there. You just assume that they're not going to do anything to you because CNN's there, right? But that doesn't, again, what is it? So you have a whole bunch of academics that go there that's provoking the police, that's using their language, that's getting the spotlight, that's attacking people. I'm just, so when y'all leave, because none of y'all are going to be from there, y'all flying in there, when y'all leave, how are these police going to treat this community? Like, we saw the second person that was killed there, the brother who was mentally disturbed that had a knife in it, they just slaughtered him.
Right.
Slaughtered. He wasn't even near them. They just destroyed him, just killed him, and they got it on camera. And that's what I'm saying, man. This is what they're doing to people that are from there. We think that this is going to stop because some people came on and put a camera on. There's a backlash that's going to come. And unless the federal government, unless the FBI is going to step in and do what they did back in the civil rights movement, then we're going to have to deal with the fact that many of these people's attempts to seek popularity is going to come with more black people dying. But you know, and that's what I mean when I say that we need to take a step back sometimes, and before we start telling people what to do, we should ascertain the risks of it. Because we need a lot more lawyers, we need a lot more activists, we need a lot more people that are actually experienced with this type of issue before we can start talking about what black people need to do. Because when these cops decide they're dissatisfied and go on a rage and start killing other black people, we have to do this exact same thing because we're not building in protections. We're not building in plans. We're not ascertaining the actual situation of Ferguson. We're not ascertaining the psychology of the police department. None of those things are being discussed right now. All we're talking about is they killed this black boy. And I'm saying we should talk about that, but talk about it in context. That the police department's always had this relationship. They're part of this network which did X, Y, and Z, right? We need to know what we're sending people into and what we're asking them to do. Because I guarantee you people are not ready to have the blood of all these people on their hands because they haven't thought this through yet.
Mm. Wow. I have a whole different perspective on pretty much every time that this happens. The T-shirts come out with "I am Renisha McBride" or "I am Mike Brown" or "I am Trayvon
right.
Martin." If people really understood that, they would understand. Like in the next 5 seconds, yeah, that could be you. Where your corpse is out in the street for the next five hours.
That's what I'm talking about. We're seeing that. Gus, that right there is the point. You see, this is what I mean. Black people, specifically black academics, don't write as if that's them. They write so that they can observe other people and make their careers off of talking about other people who are not them. In other words, they don't really feel that they could be a Trayvon Martin or Renisha McBride because they're like, look, I'm a class 7 from them. I have a PhD. I live in a middle-class life. I don't mess with the cops. I'm safe. So it's because they feel like they're safe and they don't go back to those neighborhoods, right, that they can talk about those people unproblematically. You see, and that's what I'm saying is the problem. Right, like I get stopped all the time. I'm in the South. I get stopped. You know, white people do all kind of crazy things. Like I still don't. Like when I was growing up, you know, white boy called me a nigger and spit on my brother and I when we were walking down the street on the sidewalk. So I don't walk on sidewalks in the South. Right, I stay off of the sidewalk because I know what they do. But that's not the kind of anxiety that people bring with them. So when they wear those shirts, they don't really empathize with the fear that most black men walk around with on a daily basis. They have no knowledge of it, right? They don't understand what it means to protect yourself, to always be watching how many people are around you or what's around you and trying to stay out of trouble. Make sure you don't really, no identification with that whatsoever. They'll wear a T-shirt saying that you could be Trayvon Martin, but you don't have any of the risks that come along that's associated with that. You're doing it for show. Like your solidarity is going to bring that person back. We need to show solidarity, but we need to bring solidarity to a realistic playing field. Not where we buy shirts, but where we're talking about, here's a program of study. Here's what it means. Here's what I'm working with a lawyer. Here's what this lawyer is going to say. Here's a long-term vision. Here's a short-term vision. Here's how we're interacting with these people. That needs to be the conversation, and that doesn't happen overnight. That means that you have to dedicate yourself in everything that you do from here on out about trying to figure out the deaths of black people. Or how to organize or help the black community. And that's not everybody's first sentiment. That's just the reality of it.
Mm. I will read the sentence again. I think it has a lot of value for what we have been discussing. And unfortunately, this is a core aspect of what racism and white supremacy is all about. because black men die and black men are decentered as the normative subject of thinking, there is a collective forgetting that collapses them to their corpses and not their activity. A lot of that this summer. Suspect that will continue as long as this system is in place. Dr. Tommy J. Curry, I'm super thankful we could have you on the program this evening. Techie,
sorry about the mix-up.
No apologies needed. I'm sure listeners appreciated us hanging out and being here when you dialed in so that we could have the program. I will drop you that email this week.
Please
about
do.
Your student. Love to have him on the program to hear about his dissertation. So just be on the lookout for that, and please continue your great scholarship. I know a lot of the listeners are big fans of your work. They always look forward to hearing you on the program. We definitely will look forward to having you back on the program in the near future to resume the conversation.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Enjoy the rest of your evening, and we will speak soon, Dr. Curry.
All right, sir. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Context of white supremacy. We will be back tomorrow. We will have Dr. Charles Hayden, professor, New York. As I said, he was interviewed by NPR to talk about the riots that took place in Harlem the summer of 1964 after a black teenager was shot and killed, 15 years old, by NYPD. They rioted, quote unquote, for about 6 days. They had him on, I think the piece aired the day that Eric Garner was choked to death. Now, I could be in error about that. It was either the day of or the day before, but it was almost 50 years to the day that this teenage black child was shot and killed, that Eric Garner was choked to death. I emailed him to have him on because I was like, oh, wow, you know, I didn't know anything about this incident either. So to talk about his recollections of that, because he had a lot of vivid memories of exactly what Dr. Tommy Curry just said, armed white brutes with badges and guns and batons roaming the streets in this black residential area in New York, Harlem, and beating, bludgeoning, arresting black people at will with impunity for about 6 days. And I wanted to have him on to get that. And then, adding on top of that, what happened with Eric Garner. Then all of this happened. He didn't get back in touch with me until about a week ago, but he, you know, said he'd be down to come and chat with us. And wow, now the conversation has expanded mightily. It will be interesting to hear his perspective on these issues, since he's old. People are older. He's older than I am. He's significantly older than I am, so he's older. But to hear his thoughts, since he has seen this sort of thing time and time again, the response, and, you know, how we go about talking about dealing with these incidents. Again, Dr. Charles Hayden, I think you can look online and see some of the reports that he's written about what happened with the 1964 riot. And he might even have some current thoughts on what happens in Ferguson and what's happened, the march they had in New York this past weekend over Mr. Garner's death and the other numerous instances. But that'll be tomorrow, same program time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Mr. Norm Stamper will be with us on Thursday, normal broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, white male and former chief of the Seattle Police Department. Very much looking forward to hearing what he has to say about these events, what Dr. Welsing shared on Sunday, and why the most crucial aspect of his book, in my opinion, was completely omitted from CNN's interview with him last week. But we'll be on every day this week. Stay tuned. If you have confusion, questions, problems, concerns, feel free, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Untiljustice@gmail.com. We are on Twitter at UntilJustice. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Racism-notes.blogspot.com. Racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported counter racist radio. PayPal is in the top right corner. If you are not feeling PayPal, drop me an email and we should be able to nab a mailing address if you would feel more comfortable investing that way. Thanks to all the folks who have supported us and kept us on the air for 5+ years. Again, we'll be back in about 24 hours. Thanks for everyone who chimed in. One of our tweeters said, I think that black life is studied to document the success of policies that keep us poor, uneducated, etc., and tweaked accordingly. I totally agree. White people are not ignorant. They are scientific in their study and practice of white supremacy racism. But we will be back tomorrow. Again, Dr. Charles Hayden. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in, and thanks for being patient. Myself included. Always say that at the end of the program. Be patient. It took a little patience for today's program. I'm glad we were on and hanging out. If we hadn't been hanging out for Dr. Curry to chime in, program wouldn't even have happened. So thanks to the folks who were patient, hanging out, listening in before he arrived. And thanks for Gus as well for being patient, because we wouldn't have had a program to begin with. Creator, we ask that you help us be honest about our predicament under the system of racism, white supremacy. Help us be truthful about the fact that whites are not ignorant about racism, white supremacy. They have no regard for black life, black males, black females, black children. They have no regard for black life. Let that infuse our thoughts, speech, actions, and emotions at all times in all areas of people activity. Help that truth propel us towards a permanent solution to this problem. Racist man, racist woman, racist child, the system of white supremacy. It has been time. Produce justice. Immediately. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.